Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Action Radio. This is Greg Penglis coming to you from the historic district of downtown Milton on the banks of the beautiful Blackwater River. And now let's get into Action Radio.
Yeah, greetings from Milton, Florida here on the banks of the beautiful Blackwater River, where it's pretty dark outside, you know, not because the time zone changed or anything else, but because we start an hour earlier now. So whereas I used to have my blinds open, get that early morning sun, it's not working. It's not working at all. We have a tremendous amount of information to cover today, and this is one of those days where, once again, we're going to be, you know, proposing things that no one's ever thought of, making broadcast history, and doing the things that we do best, which is just shatter the rules, you know, go boldly forth. We're kind of like the Star Trek, kind of like the Enterprise of radio broadcasting, because we do ask questions that no one's thought of, we do take actions that no one has even contemplated, and we do, you know, push the boundaries of what people think. And one of the ways we're going to do that is that I have proposed, and this is to Jonathan Mosley. We're going to talk to him at 7:30 Central Time, so it'll be 8:30 Eastern. I'm going to talk to him about filing a lawsuit with the Supreme Court to rule the federal budget unconstitutional. And I just want to let you sit with that for a minute. I want to talk about this just for a bit, and then we're going to get to Jane Adams, who is our medical freedom reporter. And she was on last week, did such a fantastic job. I invited her to be a regular reporter here at Action Radio. So that's how it happens. So listen, if you're good at what you do, you know, this is a place of promotion. This is a place of opportunity. You know, and ironically, I don't think any of us are what you would call broadcast professionals. I don't have a communication degree. I don't have a broadcast degree. I don't have a law degree, yet I write legislation. You know, I don't have any number of degrees that you would think I would have. I don't have an English degree, but I write articles all the time. You know, we just do things here because, you know, we can. And so I thought of this just the other day. I thought that I knew that the federal budget was unconstitutional. So here's basically what I'm going to talk to Jonathan about. So I want to kind of let this kind of sit for a bit, and then we'll get to it again in the second hour. The federal budget, you know, why would we bring this to the Supreme Court? Well, because so obviously it's an open and shut case. Obviously the federal budget is unconstitutional because it obviously exceeds you know, Article 1, Section 8 with Social Security, Medicare, and the entitlements alone. And that's most of the budget. So it's about 75% of the budget is unconstitutional. We went over that yesterday. And so what I'm curious about, first of all, we have to educate people. And the reason I'm doing this is a massive education process. You know, why would anybody bring a case that the federal budget is unconstitutional? You know, because it is. You know? And then the next thing, let me shuffle my microphone around a little bit here. The next thing is, let's find out what the reaction is going to be from the Supreme Court. What are they going to do with this? Because it is so obviously an open and shut case. They can't argue against it because the federal budget is so obviously unconstitutional, yet they're going to. So this is going to be fun to watch. And the other thing is, and probably one of the bigger reasons I'm doing this is where we find out where our friends are and where we find out, you know, from the conservative and the legal foundations that allegedly are trying to help this country. This is where we find out who our friends are, who are actually going to take action, and those who want to continue with their luncheons and guest speakers and, you know, overpriced at that. And the organizations that raise millions upon millions of dollars and have fewer ideas than we have, you know, before breakfast. And so that's what we're talking about here. So let's Jean's on the line now too. She'll come on in a bit. I'm sure she's producing, doing that producing thing. But I want to get to Jane here. Well, Jean, good morning. How are you now that you're here?
Good morning.
What's
great.
Going on? Yeah.
Yeah. Just what's going on in the news? A lot of exciting things about to happen.
Okay.
It's
good.
Well, it's going to be the month.
No kidding. Well, first of all, let's get a little cheer for our reporter. Medical freedom. So we have a bunch of things to talk about. with Jane Adams here, who's doing incredible work herself. And so I'm just going to kind of turn it over to you. We've talked about topics. I know pretty much where you're going to go. I have some things I think might surprise you. I've got an article from Natural News that I can't possibly put on Facebook. I can't even put it in Messenger. It's so good. About how 50,000 people have been killed so far with the vaccines. Now, of course, we can talk about that here because we can talk about pretty much anything here as long as we can back it up. I don't do insults, personal attacks, things like that. But I don't care how controversial the topic. This isn't social media. You know, this is my media. So we can do that. Jane, good morning. How are you today?
Good morning. I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm on a roll, and I'm still getting used to this earlier hour because for over 2.5 years we broadcast from 7 to 9 Central Time, and just because of wonderful folks like you and sponsors and people that are helping out, that little 2-hour period was getting too crowded, and so we're now able to go to 3 hours. But again, you can tell me this. You're in the health professions. How long does it take to get used to an hour time difference, like for daylight savings and things like that? Or if you start your job an hour earlier, or in our case, our show an hour earlier, how that's got to mess with your biorhythms or whatever they call it.
Yeah, it takes just as long for as soon as you adjust, the next time change comes. That's what I've experienced.
So it doesn't matter. I'm always going to be adjusting. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly.
Okay. All right. Well, let's get into the main stuff here. What's happening in medical freedom? What are you working on? And of course, I have questions for you, but let's get started with where you want to go today.
Okay. I want to start out early this morning, jumping right into something I mentioned last week, which is the CMS guidelines.
Okay.
So I'm just going to read straight from their website. So for those who don't know, CMS is the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services. So this is kind of the governing body over Medicaid and Medicare. So any healthcare organization that accepts Medicaid or Medicare for reimbursement, which is virtually all of them, follow these guidelines. Okay, so this is a statement released on August 2nd. Stating that there's going to be some new guidelines if you are someone who accepts Medicaid and Medicare. So this is going to take effect on October 1st. Okay, so it was put out on August 2nd, but it's taking effect in a couple days.
Yeah,
so
tomorrow, I think.
So I don't want my personal opinion, entangled in this. So like I said, I'm just going to read straight from CMS.gov on this statement.
Oh, my personal opinion is going to be on it. I've read this. I've got it. Listen, I'll you don't have to say anything. Like I say, you're free to say as much or as little as you want. However, I'm going to be very personal in this because I've got some things here that just jumped right out at me. So let me see what you have to say.
Yeah.
And I won't bias your description of this, but stand by. I got a few things coming that I want to ask you about.
The title, if anybody would like to look it up, the title is CMS Final Rule, Improves Health Equity, Access to Treatment, Hospital Readiness, and COVID-19 Vaccination Data Reporting of Hospital Workers. And again, this was released August 2nd. So I just want to read a couple sentences that jumped out at me. So it says, the final rule effective October 1st, 2021, authorizes additional payments for diagnostics and therapies to treat COVID-19. So they're saying in a couple of days, they're increasing payment for diagnostic and therapies. So
of course they are. This is where the money is.
Right.
Sorry, but this is where the money is. Yeah. Okay.
Hashtag follow the money. Okay.
Right.
So next portion I want to highlight, CMS is also adopting a measure that requires hospitals and long-term care hospitals to report COVID-19 vaccination rates of workers in their facilities. Having access to information about COVID-19 vaccination rates among healthcare personnel will help patients, caregivers, and their communities make informed decisions when seeking care from hospitals, cancer centers, and long-term care hospitals. Okay.
Uh-huh.
Next.
I'm waiting. It's my turn in a bit.
let's see. Using lessons learned from the COVID-19 pandemic, these final rules will enact policies that will further protect and deliver better care to Medicare beneficiaries. These payment rules finalize new quality measures to give beneficiaries and their families better insight into the quality of care rendered at hospice facilities and vaccination reporting of facility staff. So this is saying that they're releasing hospitalization or hospital workers' vaccination rates, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And yep. It does not clearly say it, but one could interpret that the reimbursement from CMS is going to be affected by what that rate is. So hospitals that have higher rates of vaccination, that will be, they'll be higher reimbursed. So when all of these healthcare facilities are saying that they're mandating the COVID-19 vaccine to protect staff, to protect other employees, to protect their patients, I call BS, because that, number one, the vaccine, as everyone knows, this is, you can't even debate this anymore because it's so widely known. It does not prevent you from contracting it or spreading it to others. So this whole propaganda line of saying that, you know, it's an act of love for your patients, that scientifically does not make sense. And here we have on CMS.gov, they're saying that they are reporting vaccination rates of hospital workers in order to receive reimbursement, plain and simple.
So I got a question. I have a bunch of questions, but the first one is, are these the folks that set the guidelines for how much doctors are paid or nurses are paid for various medical treatments? Is this where it comes from?
I don't know the answer to that question. I do know that they set rates of rates of reimbursement for certain treatments. So there is a patient that is, you know, they're using Medicare or Medicaid to pay for their services.
Mm-hmm.
CMS is the one who determines how much hospitals will be reimbursed.
Okay.
And, you know, one of the first things that I read off is that they're increasing that rate for diagnosis and treatment. So things like, you know, PCR testing or remdesivir, ventilation, all of that, hospitals are going to be paid even more now.
Ventilation, that has about a 97% death rate, doesn't it?
The ventilation, you said?
Yep. Obviously, I've looked this up.
Yeah,
yeah. I'm not just pulling that figure out of nowhere. Yeah, that's the problem.
Heard,
Gina confirmed it too.
Yeah,
we've talked about this.
Yeah, 97%. Yeah, that's about the rate I've heard.
So why would you reimburse more something that kills 97% of the people that are on it? I'm not asking you specifically. I'm just saying, but why would anybody do that? Why would they push this? Why would you do everything to keep people off? Why wouldn't you do everything to keep people off ventilators? Go ahead, and I'll ask my next question.
So those treatments are very expensive, and as we're talking about now, they're being reimbursed at a higher rate.
Mm-hmm.
So let's look at early treatment and
let's look at early treatment.
There's no financial gain for early treatment. And so it's your main goal.
How about that?
If your main goal is, you know, financial gain, then things like, you know, losing weight, proper nutrition, vitamin D, you know, ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, zinc, all of those things that have been proven time and time again to be effective, those are, you know, they're very effective in saving lives, but that's not what we're worried about. We're worried about the financial gain.
Yeah. I hate to ask this. Well, actually, I don't hate, but it just the idea that this question even exists bothers me. There's really more money in death than there is in life here, isn't there? I mean, they're really –
that's what to me.
Do you want to expand on that? You know what I'm talking about, right?
I mean, yeah, that's it. I mean, you don't really have to expand on that sentence. It's clear.
Okay.
We're seeing more reimbursement, more money coming into hospitals from people being hospitalized and from their death rather than saving lives.
Yeah. people, I want to let that sentence kind of sink into everybody that, and this is, we may do an entire show on this, that there is more money in death. There is more money in your friends and family and your relatives and cousins dying, whether it's by ventilator, whether it's by remdesivir, whether it's by just waiting too long to get to the hospital, whether it's all kinds of means, when the cures are so obvious, so proven, and so inexpensive that death is more profitable than life, and that's why this continues. Jean, did you want to get in this?
You know, I can't fathom it. I should, but that is horrible to think that okay, if you put someone on a ventilator, ding, 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 more money, and it's like, that's the last thing you want to put someone on if they've got COVID. You know, people making these laws,
mm-hmm.
they should be taken to court. I mean, that's insane.
Well, I mean, obviously, this is.
Well, I guess they're following Dr. Fauci's recommendations, but wow, that is just tragic.
Yeah.
I would like to add too. There.
Go ahead.
I definitely don't believe that it's, you know, the doctors and the nurses that are on these floors treating the patients. I think the vast majority, I would probably say, all of them, do not have, you know, this financial gain. Incentive. I think they really are in, you know, from their perspective, they're doing what's right because they're doing what they're told. I don't think it's the doctors and the nurses who are, you know, ill-intended putting people on ventilators just to, because it doesn't directly affect them financially. It's the people who are governing them. So it's the, you know, upper hospital administrators. And I mean, I've heard personal accounts from nurses and doctors, numerous accounts from people I've spoken to personally that felt uneasy about doing these treatments, but they were so scared of retaliation, not just losing their job, but losing their license. And so I think we just have to remember, you know, that most of the people treating are – they're trying to do what's best. I think more and more people are waking up, but we really have to focus on the administrative level because there's
no. I agree. I absolutely agree with you, but I think people have a certain responsibility to learn what's out there and not just take what they're given. You know, it's the extreme example, of course, is the Nuremberg War Trials of German Nazis who said we were just following orders. Okay, just following orders is not an excuse. It wasn't an excuse for the Holocaust. It wasn't an excuse for torture. It wasn't an excuse for any of the things that were happening in Nazi Germany. We use that example because we won. Okay, so we were able to put the Nazis on trial. But I look at someone like Dr. Fascist, and Dr. Fascist is everybody as evil as Dr. Mengele. You know, you look at, in fact, probably more so because he's killed so many more people. He's had access to so many more people worldwide. That he's been able to get rid of in the interest of his personal profits. And this goes back, we've had Judy Mikovits on, this goes back to AZT and AIDS. So this guy's been killing people since the 80s, and yet he's still there. Okay, so there is some very, very scary things going on here. I don't blame the medical professionals. I think that they are doing the best they can. I think they are definitely, there comes a point where they are following orders too. And so what I want to do, I'm not going to put them on trial for war crimes, but what I do want to do is encourage them to go beyond their orders, to look beyond that. And medical professionals, we've got Dr. Zelenko, who's a friend of the show here, who wrote The President and said, look, this stuff works. And, of course, the president went on it, and he was fine. He caught COVID, but my guess is he caught COVID after he started listening to, you know, Dr. Fascist and the good minions, you know, under him. And then he caught it, and then he ended up in the hospital. He got Regeneron and other things. But I think if he stayed on the hydroxychloroquine, he would have been fine. Peter Navarro had 60 million hydroxychloroquine tablets ready to distribute to all over the country here. And Dr. Fascist stopped it. We could have stopped the pandemic back in March of 2020. It would have lasted maybe 2 to 3 weeks, however long it takes to boost that immunity using hydroxychloroquine, zinc, vitamin D3, vitamin C, which is what I take every day. Well, I take quercetin, which is the non-prescription alternative. If I get sick, believe me, I'm going to get a prescription. I will get my hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin. I am not, you know, going to have a problem with this. But I think I had it back, like I said before, I had it, and I got the shows to prove it because they found a hell. January of 2020, before we knew what this was, and I've been fine ever since. I mean, literally, I haven't caught anything since I had what I think was COVID back in, January almost 2 years ago, which is quite fascinating. Anyway, this idea of following orders, of that's what they're told. How is it that people like Dr. Simone Gold and Dr. Stella Emanuel, Dr. Zelenko, Dr. Mikovits, people that are starting America's frontline doctors, the telemed doctors all over the country that are getting people hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin, the people that went to this conference where I was just reading in Natural News, the source you can't put on social media, that they're saying 45,000 to 50,000 people, Medicaid people, have died within 2 weeks of getting their shot. How is it that these people, you know, have crossed the barrier, have gotten away from the just following medical orders, and have actually gotten out and found the right thing? And they all seem to be coming up with the same stuff: hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, early treatment, you know, get this as soon as possible, boost your immune system, the same treatments that boost your immune system, cure COVID, and they also protect you from the shedding of spike proteins by the what I call the vaccine injured. There's two types of people in the world now: vaccine injured and DNA normal. So how do we get more? Well, see, language is a big thing with me. I always, you know, redo the terms so that they fit my narrative. So then the question becomes, how do we reach those other doctors, those other professionals? I mean, hopefully you will be able to share this with all your medical professional friends who will share it with all their medical professional friends. And this gets around, and all the people that are out there sharing the things, Dr. Zelenko's videos, the one I just talked about, Natural News, which I'm going to talk about a little bit later. You know, I don't know. I hope you can stay the whole hour, because I think we're going to keep you for a bit. But how do we get these doctors and nurses and medical people across that line where they start investigating? Any ideas?
It takes one person at a time. I think that a lot of people are, I mean, they're just afraid to step out and be the first one to be outspoken and, you know, share their name with the world, mm-hmm. share their ideas with the world. And it just takes one person at a time. And seeing each other being bold and courageous, you know, will encourage and motivate others. I can't share too much information right now. I'll probably be able to next week, but I know there is a stirring of that happening in our community. So there is a group of certain healthcare workers that's developing in our community that are coming together. So it is happening.
And they're welcome on the show, and none of them have to give their real name. I mean, we can just – I have a lot of lines that I can use here. So if you have like four or five people that want to come on someday, you know, during the medical freedom, which is probably going to become the medical freedom hour, something tells me, they're welcome to. You know, it's just invite them on. See who wants to do this.
I'll let them know.
Okay. I want to talk a little bit more about this CMS final rule. So what does CMS stand for? Help me out again. Oh, Center for Medical and Medicaid Services. That's right? That's from the website.
Yeah.
Okay.
Medicare and Medicaid.
The words that jumped out at me immediately was health equity. This is Marxist, you know, we're all the same, you know, we'll suppress everybody equally so that they're all equally miserable. You know, income equity is where everybody makes, you know, minimum wage. What the hell is health equity, and are these people being taken over by the Marxist, politically correct, you know, prove your worth to the cause kind of people?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. But, you know, the agenda is to lay a blanket, you know, treatment or a blanket protocol on everybody, and that's just not how healthcare works. You cannot say, you know, that one treatment or preventative measure is right for everybody, because we're all so different. You know, there's varying ages, races, which affect, you know, medical decisions, different health, you know, health conditions. I mean, there's so many variables that go into making any medical decision, and it's not right, and it's not rooted in science, and it's definitely not ethical to say that every person should be doing the same thing with healthcare.
Yeah. Isn't that the whole philosophy of our healthcare is that, it, like everything else in our country, as it should be, it's individual. You go to a doctor,
right.
You go to a nurse practitioner, you go to a specialist, you go to somebody who evaluates you. You know, you don't line up with a big long line and everybody, you know, get the same shot like they're trying to do now. We're not a population. This isn't groupthink. We don't have group medicine. Medicine's individual. Isn't that the whole point of it?
Yep. You would think. I mean, you would think that's why doctors and nurses go to school for so long and it requires so much quality training and experience, because it's not one size fits all. There's so many things that you have to consider, so many variables, and, you know, it takes someone who's highly trained, highly experienced to make, to help the patient make these decisions.
Oh, wait a minute. So you just said something very significant, to help the patient make these health decisions. That is critical.
Yep. I think that's the job of health workers. You know, they, they're there to help inform the patient, you know, weigh risk and benefits, give their professional guidelines, options of, you know, treatment. And, but ultimately it's up to the patient.
Yeah. And patients can be wrong and patients can be right. You know, the whole under Donald, the right to try, you know, and you have to accept responsibility. If your doctor advises you, like my doctor said to me, I gained a lot of weight after open heart surgery. I had a mitral valve prolapse, so they did a little trim of my heart. Of course, it took a while to get there. You know, it's rather invasive, but I gained a ton of weight afterwards and other problems. And with the stress of actually getting Action Radio going, now it's a lot better than it was when we first started. But there was a lot of work, and I was the only person, you know, that was actually around to do it. And so gained more weight. And so they said, start losing. So I've actually, you know, taken that advice seriously. And I always did, but I just never was in a position to do it. So I'm losing like 5 pounds a week right now, which is marvelous. I mean, I'm feeling better and better all the time. But it's a personal responsibility and a personal challenge. And the one thing, for those of you that are trying to lose weight, the first thing I learned, here's what I do. I stop eating at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. You know, and it's cold water from then on. So I'm really hungry by the morning. So right before the show starts, I'm kind of ravenous. But it's actually working. You know, and the part about weight loss, and you confirm this, maybe Gene can too, you know, experience with you or others, but it's the hardest part about losing weight is starting to lose weight. You know, once you're actually losing it, I mean, I'm finding this kind of easy. It's easier to not eat than it is to eat at this point. And I'm feeling better and better each week, because, you know, if I drop 5 pounds a week, you know, I'll be at my goal here in a few months and be like, yes. Yeah. Wow. This could be fun. I think I'll take up a martial art. I mean, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do, but I'm going to have all this extra energy and, you know, much less weight. Do you find that too? The personal, that's the other thing is the doctors and nurses and health practitioners need to go beyond the orders, but the patients, us, you know, us consumers of medical services, we have to go beyond and we have to put in the effort and we have to do our own research and we have to be good patients and we have to ask questions and we have to demand that, you know, if we're not being prescribed hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin, why not? Well, it doesn't work. Well, it does work. Yeah. Here's the study. You know, I just need you to sign this. You know, I mean, how much responsibility do you think the patient has, you know, in the doctor-patient relationship?
I think they have full responsibility. My own personal experience has been that asking questions is the challenge because asking questions is seen as objecting to, you know, medical advice. And so I think that's what we need to not only normalize, but encourage. Doctors and nurses should be encouraging patients to ask questions. You know, whether it's routine care, you're talking about, you know, an extreme medical procedure, whatever it is, whatever the scenario is, patients should be asking a lot of questions, and they should not feel intimidated or awkward to ask those questions. I think that's the issue, because how can you be informed and advocate for yourself if you don't even feel comfortable asking simple questions to your provider? So that's what I would start with, is if you, you know, as a patient, whatever specialist you're seeing, whatever provider you're seeing, if you don't feel comfortable asking questions, then please find a new provider. Because your provider should be encouraging you to be well informed before consenting to anything.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I'm not someone that rushes into medical treatments at all. But when it came to heart surgery, I didn't get a second opinion. I got a fifth opinion. I mean, I literally asked, you know, cardiologists, surgeons. I asked different people. I asked, you know, all the folks in this kind of specialty. You know, from the people that did the MRI, the whole bit. I mean, I really sought out this, and when I decided to do it, it was an easy decision because they're like, yeah, this makes sense. And I think, you know, I'm going to be in really great shape for a long time because of it. So, I don't, you know, even though it was a challenge, I think overall, It was absolutely the right thing to do. But I asked a ton of questions. You know, I asked, you know, you wouldn't believe. And I was like, you know, pain in the butt. So why are you asking me so many questions? Because I want to know. It's my heart. I'm, you know, you goof this up, I'm stuck with it. Okay. You know, anyway, I want to just do one more paragraph on this, and then I want to get to the medical exemptions and the religious exemptions and see what the latest is on that.
Okay.
But we've got this section. This is, we're back to CMS. So everyone wants to look this up. Okay. It's CMS.gov. And it's the press release, CMS final rule improves health equity, access to treatment, hospital readiness, and COVID-19 vaccination data reporting of hospital workers. It's August 2nd, 2021, Medicare Parts A and B, and that's where it is. They don't have an author, so they're not putting a name on this. So, yeah, but health equity. Let's talk about the Marxist healthcare system that's setting up for it here, us here. It says, in an effort to advance equity through the quality reporting measurement, CMS solicited feedback on opportunities to leverage diverse data sets such as race, ethnicity, Medicare, Medicaid dual eligibility status, disability status, LGBTQ+, and socioeconomic status. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but if I have a health problem, does it matter, you know, whether me or anybody else is LGBTQ, what my socioeconomic status is, what my race might be, what my diversity quotient might be? What the hell is this? That's the part that jumped out at me.
I think there's actually pros and cons to that. I'll play devil's advocate.
Okay.
I don't think that it's important for that to be public information, obviously.
Okay.
And certainly not gathered on a wide scale like this is talking about, you know, and released. But sometimes race does affect medical decisions. You know, certain races and ethnicities are more prone or less prone to certain things. Same with socioeconomic class. If, you know, people who are in lower income houses may be more prone to certain environmental aspects that affect health.
Mm-hmm. So I understand that for studies.
But yeah.
I don't think that's why they're doing this.
I don't understand why CMS is highlighting that. Yeah.
Yeah, well, it says right here, the agency received more than 200 comments reflecting the importance stakeholders, I'm not sure what that means, place on this Biden-Harris administration priority. And I only said it because of the word administration is there. As far as I'm concerned, it's an illegal occupation. All right, CMS will consider the feedback it received to inform future actions. So this is definitely the new insurrection. This is the new healthcare. This is the Marxist equity. This is we're gonna make everybody equal except for the folks that are special. We're gonna make them elevated. And the idea that they're gonna report vaccine data, that you know, this is medical segregation. This is two-tier medical. This is medical discrimination. You know, all of a sudden, you know, I want to get your comments on this. But you know, the fact is, if I'm able to find out, you know, which health providers are, shall we say, non-DNA injured, that's where I'm going. The places that don't require you to wear a mask, that's where I'm going. So in a kind of backwards way, I think as they're trying to get rid of or reduce the business places that are not requiring, you know, vaccine injury and are not requiring, you know, facial diapers, you know, the places that those are the ones I'm going to go to. But that's not the intent of this. I believe the intent of this is to segregate out those that aren't towing the party line, that aren't medically, ideologically aligned with the Biden-Harris coup, and is a way to get them out of business. That's what I think is going on here.
That's their intent for sure. Okay. Maybe I'm just being too optimistic here, but I don't think this is going to pan out how they planned it to. I think that the majority of people don't care. I mean, at least the circle that I'm involved with, which is mostly like-minded people, but I know that most people don't care if their provider is vaccinated or not. I think this is just part of, you know, the propaganda. It's part of the kind of psychological warfare aspect of this, is trying to make people think that they should care if their provider is vaccinated or not. But I don't think most people put too much weight on that. And I think that it's gonna backfire and really just point people to the ones who don't have this mandate.
Yeah, Yeah. I mean, I still have faith in people, but people have to be informed. You know, it's not that people are stupid, it's that they're ignorant. And I don't mean ignorant in a derogatory sense. I'm saying they're ignorant because information is purposely being withheld from them. If the vast majority of Americans knew that hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin, you know, early treatments stop COVID cold, you know, and that you can take those same things as a preventive, there never would have been a pandemic. You know, if everybody had got the information that I released March 2nd of 2020, that chloroquine kills COVID from the Dieter Raoul study, and the reason I keep mentioning it is because that's how far ahead this knowledge was available, okay? If it was available to me, you know, little Greg looking up on a website, you know, doing a little bit of research, finding out the multiple ways to kill viruses, I had all the information I needed in about 2 hours, okay? It didn't take a lot of digging. It's out there. And yet that information has been – it's still being suppressed to this day. So that's the problem.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Hopefully you have the whole hour. If you don't, let me know how much time you have so then I can sort of gear what I want to talk about.
I have to get probably like 10 or 15 minutes, actually.
Okay, that's perfect. All right. So there's a fundraising campaign here, Florida Ascension Legal Counsel Funds. Can you talk about that?
I will. So that is – well, first let me talk about the reason why we're trying to gain legal counsel. So the fundraiser is for us to secure a lawyer on our behalf. This is for Florida Ascension Associates. This is happening all across the nation. This particular fundraiser for Florida Associates. But the reason why we're needing legal counsel is because the healthcare industry is denying religious and medical exemptions literally by the thousands.
I've heard, I got friends.
There's the people that I'm connected with, which is, you know, the support group is over, we're almost at 2,000 people now.
Okay.
Not one of them I've heard of has been approved. And there's no reason given. There's no room for appeal. It's just flat out denied. Even people who have had religious exemptions in the past, so that's evidence that their religious beliefs are genuine and, you know, it's well documented for years. Now all of a sudden their exemptions are denied. And that is not lawful. You cannot deny religious exemptions, and especially
that's what they're called exemptions. That's what they're called exemptions. You know, because you can't deny them.
Exactly. So we need help fighting for our religious freedoms, and for, you know, I think the majority of people are opting out due to religious beliefs.
Right.
But there are some people that are trying to get medical exemptions. So we're trying to fight for our right for medical and religious freedom. In addition to the exemption issue, I touched on it, I think, briefly last week, but there's so much harassment and discrimination and coercion happening if you are an unvaccinated person within the healthcare system. So I know, you know, myself personally, and I know three other cases that this has just happened this week, have filed complaints to HR, to the HR system, and, you know, it's a formal process. You have to, you know, document everything that occurred, exact dates and times. One case that I heard of has a 6-page document of all of the times this person was harassed. And by, you know, just an example is they were brought into a room by themselves and repeatedly asked why they've not received the vaccine. The person already had denied it multiple times. And the manager, and you know, continue to intimidate and question this person. So these are the types of examples that, you know, are well documented and reported to HR. And the response from the human resource department is to completely sweep that report under the rug. There's zero communication with the person complaining. The case is closed without any resolution, with, you know, no communication for the person who's complaining. And so this is just completely, you know, I'm mind blown that this is happening, but I guess I really shouldn't be that surprised. But that's the whole point of a human resource department. You know, even if the internal people within the system don't agree with our perspective or they don't think that it's harassment, that doesn't matter. The point is that every single complaint should be investigated, and there's no investigation happening. So we have healthcare workers submitting complaints for harassment and discrimination with a 6-page document, you know, with exact dates and times, and it's completely right. ignored, and the case is closed, and there's no appeal process. So that's, again, why we're, you know, why we need legal counsel is to help us, because we've exhausted all pathways internally with the healthcare system, and so the next line of defense is legal counsel.
Yeah, I got some ideas for you. I'll probably talk to you more about these off the air, but they're legal. There's like Chris Ann Hall, constitutional attorney. There are the Ed Meese organizations he set up, Pacific Legal Foundation. I'd say the closest one here is Southeast Legal Foundation. There's Liberty Council. There's different organizations. I got a list of them. I can dig them up for you. But those are the places I would go. Are you working with any other hospital associations, hospital corporations, large groups in the country, or is this is just the beginning of what could be a much larger umbrella of health workers, you know, across all kinds of different companies?
Yeah, there's we're in communication with several different healthcare systems.
Okay.
We are a lot of us have reached out to some of those, you know, the legal supporters that you mentioned, but they're being so inundated right now with inquiries that it is hard, you know, to get responses. I've reached out, you know, legal counsel, everyone keeps pointing me to them, and I think they're going to be a great resource, but they're just so, you know, overrun and just so busy right now because all of the other lawyers are being silenced and intimidated. And, you know, it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, just doing what you're told. I personally called probably 5 or 6 law firms. Some were local, some were like more well-known that are nationwide. And I just, you know, they acted like they were going to help me. And then I was denied help. And they just simply say, we cannot take this type of case at this time. And I asked for reasoning, and they say, we're not at liberty to say, we just cannot take a case like this right now. And so they're being silenced, they're being intimidated to, you know, if it has anything to do with COVID-19 or the vaccines, they are not allowed to help.
What do you mean by, I wonder what you mean by not allowed to help. My first question was, do you think that it's because there's no money in your cases? But the second thing is, what do you mean they're not allowed to help? Where does that, why do you think they're not allowed to help? Are they being coerced?
Yes. I mean, I asked for reasoning, and they say they're not allowed to take this type of case. I mean, that was
really?
The wording that was used.
Did you ask them? I'm not accusing you. I want to make sure that, you know, I'm on your side, but I'm mad at this. You know, and I'm just trying to think, why did you, were you able to ask them why they weren't able to take this type of case? And did they give you an answer?
I asked repeatedly, and they just say, we are not at liberty to say, we cannot take this case right now.
And these are law firms you're talking about, or legal foundations, or legal groups, or
they're
individual
law firms,
lawyers?
Yeah.
Law
some
firms,
are,
okay.
Some are, like, you know, local, smaller law firms. Some are very well known. All the, you know, you'll see them on commercials, you know, in the evening time. So, but we have found a lawyer to take our case. He's
okay,
out of Gainesville, Florida, and he was able to already reverse a vaccine mandate in that area. So we're very hopeful that, you know, we don't expect, it would be amazing, but we don't expect for this mandate to be completely reversed. We just want our reasonable accommodations that are legally, you know, we're legally allowed to have reasonable accommodations. We want those to be honored, and we want a reasonable compromise. Like I mentioned last week, of full immunity, full natural immunity, giving us exemption, because that is found time and time again in the literature. There's some hospitals now that are actually saying, if you have natural immunity actually, they don't even say it like that. They just say if you have had prior infection. So you just have to prove that you have had a positive test at some point, then you're allowed to just get one dose of the vaccine. So that I have not personally read evidence for that reasoning anywhere. And in fact, I've read
Go ahead. Well, let me follow this through for a second, because the vaccine, as we know, loses its potency, which is why you have to have a second one, and it loses it again, why you have to have a third one. So if you if this vaccine loses its potency all the way along the line, why is one shot sufficient? I'm not arguing for the other side here. I'm just saying that there is no logic to this. There is no consistency, because they're saying on the one hand, you have to get multiple shots to maintain your immunity, which is nowhere near as good as natural immunity, obviously, because you know, you look at Israel, the most vaccinated country in the world, also has the most COVID. That's not a coincidence. It's not a coincidence that the variants didn't come out until after December 2020 when the vaccine came out. That's not a coincidence either. Okay, I know how this works. I know about antibody-dependent enhancement. We've talked about this. We've talked about how the vaccine, you know, is designed to protect you from one particular strain, and that particular strain doesn't exist anymore. The original COVID-19 is gone, if it ever was.
Yeah.
You know, and so the variants are what's dominating now. And the this you know, we talked about how the beginning of this was in basically the end of January 2020. The peak was April 15th, and it was pretty much gone by July 4th, COVID Independence Day of 2020. Everything after that's been lies, you know, and vaccines. It's a fascinating thing. But the hypocrisy of this, you know, it's so easy to trip these people up, because they're saying on the one hand, you have to have three shots, but one shot's not good enough, you know, if you're going to do, if you've already had it. Well, if you've already had it, you have natural immunity, so no shots are good enough. You know, and if this vaccine works, then you shouldn't need three shots. I mean, where does the conflicting information stop? Where does the hypocrisy end? Well, it doesn't.
No.
It just keeps going. Yeah. Okay. That's pretty much everything I wanted to cover. Did you, because I know we have to go soon. Is there anything else that you had to advise people? Especially medical. I have friends that have autoimmune diseases, and they're being told they have to take it, but they're the people who shouldn't. You know, where for medical and religious exemptions, is there any? Let's just talk medical, because that's more your expertise. Where can people go? What kinds of things are, if any, medical exemptions are being given? What are they given for? And what's people's best options?
Sadly, no medical exemptions are being given, from what I can understand. Even if you're pregnant, that doesn't count as a medical exemption. And like you said, you know, it is very well documented in all of the safety studies that autoimmune disease is – that puts you at higher risk for injury, and that does not count. Even if you have – I know personal friends who have doctor's notes stating that they cannot receive the vaccine and their medical exemption is still denied. So their health professional is saying my patient cannot receive this vaccine due to medical conditions, and the healthcare system is not.
They don't care. Yep. So because this is about profits. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Yeah. You know, it's interesting. Go ahead.
That's why we're fighting for the legal counsel, and why we need help raising these funds in order to secure that.
Yeah, we've got Jonathan Mosley as our attorney, who's coming on in about 45 minutes. If you have the opportunity to call back, feel free. If not, I can get you guys in touch off the air. But there's just some the way this stuff is going. I want to sort of alert you to something too, and everybody else here. Natural News, which is an automatic censored report on any social media, has a report that came out yesterday, September 29th. It was by Mike Adams. And it's also in one of the lectures from the recent Colorado Springs Health and Freedom Conference. Bombshell from attorney Thomas Renz, that's R-E-N-Z, Renz. Nearly 50,000 Medicare patients died soon after getting the COVID shot. Okay, it's in Natural News. It's in other sources. You can find it. Critical information exposing vaccine genocide is now emerging. Attorney Thomas Renz presented his bombshell information. Oh, Clay Clark, Reawaken America Tour. That's what it was, in Colorado Springs. Let me just give you the highlights real quick. He says the data, he says, certain numbers. I need some background noise here. So whoever's got background, I think it might be Jean. Jean, I'm going to mute you just for a second. There we go. Okay. I'll bring her back in just a little bit here. All right. So they say right here, data from the Medicare tracking system. This is their own information. Medicare. This is CMS, I guess. This is the folks we've been talking about this morning. Medicare tracking system reveals that 19,400 people less than 80 years old have died within 14 days of receiving the COVID-19 vaccine. In addition, 28,065 people have died that are over the age of 80 within 14 days of receiving the COVID-19 vaccine. The total number of American citizens that died within 14 days of receiving the COVID-19 vaccine is 48,465, according to hard data revealed in the Medicare tracking system. And the reason that this isn't publicly known is because I guess that they say that you're not, quote, fully vaccinated until 2 weeks after you received the vaccine. And that's why they call it, is your doorbell ringing? Something's going on there. And that's why they don't report this, because you're not considered fully vaccinated until 2 weeks after the vaccine. So if you die within 2 weeks of getting the vaccine, that's not counted, even though it is. See?
Yep. That's exactly right. And
okay,
that's the same tricks that they're using when they're reporting the hospitalizations. So you'll see in the hospital that they say, you know, over 90% of people hospitalized are unvaccinated. It's because they're using that same trickery. There's, you know, on
oh,
intake,
that's
they
interesting.
Ask, yeah. So yeah. On intake, they ask, have you been vaccinated within the past 7 days? If you answer no to that question, you're considered unvaccinated. So you could be vaccinated just over, you know, you're over the 7 day threshold, which I don't know why that matters. And then you're counted as unvaccinated. So if you're, even if you're fully vaccinated and you're hospitalized, you're going to, if it wasn't within 7 days, then they're counting you as unvaccinated.
Fascinating. I know you have to go. So anything else you want to leave us with before you have to dash? I want to make sure we get what you wanted covered. Have we covered everything, or do you have another little bit?
Yeah, I think that's it. Just, yeah, okay. If everyone could just please look up that the fundraising link, and please consider donating what you can, even if it's a dollar, you know, all of that adds up, and especially, you know, help with just sharing that link, sending it to, you know, your friends, your family on social media. That would be just greatly appreciated, and you would be helping our
link one more time. Or I don't even know if we did. Do you have it there handy?
It is. It's kind of a long URL. I can send you the link, or people can email me, and I'll be glad to send it out. My email is janeadams825@gmail.com. janeadams825@gmail.com.
Okay, that's good. Yeah, I've actually posted it and shared it myself, but I closed the window. I thought I was done with it. Yeah, well, anyway. Jane, thank you so much. Yeah, this is going to become an ever more important report. So like I say, feel free to bring on guests, bring on statistics, more information. You know, you supply me with some fascinating stuff ahead of time. I never would have known about health equity and medical Marxism without some of the stuff that you sent. So thank you very much. Let's keep doing what we do. And when you get ready to propose legislation, I will show you how to be a citizen legislator, and we can write some bills. Now that I mentioned, just real quick, is there any way that you can share our bill to bring full product liability to the vaccine manufacturers and our FDA overhaul bill?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay. If you don't have those, I can send them to you easily, or just look them up on writeyourlaws.com. But I'll send it to you anyway. So let me just put send. Let me watch myself send bills. Okay. No problem. Okay. Let's get that out there. Thank you
so much.
Have a wonderful day.
You too.
All right. There we go. Jane Adams, our new medical freedom report. Oh, wait a minute. That's Jean. Hey, Jean. You know what? you probably had a question. I didn't get to. Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't want to interrupt before, but Bumper Jack had a question. Can you provide evidence that Dr. Fauci profits from the vaccines? He can't find any information.
Well, of course he can't find any information. He's not looking for it. Let me take a look here. Can Greg provide any evidence Dr. Fauci profits from the vaccines? Why, yes, I can. He has over 1,000 patents in viruses, vaccines. But do you think he's going to let people know where the money goes? Check the offshore accounts in the Cayman Islands. That's where the money is. Okay. This guy's, you know, that $500,000 he's paid, you know, of government salary, the lunch money to this guy, the real money is in the patents and the license fees and the royalties. He's making billions, I think. I think he's making just an incredible amount of money. I don't know where it's going. You know, like I say, he can't spend it, because if he spends it, he's going to look like what he is, a genocidal, psychopathic, profiting vaccine drug pusher. I mean, that's who he is, okay? So that's pretty obvious, you know, because the guy has systematically denied every inexpensive and early treatment that there is. And he did it for the simple reason that that death is – and the realization I had this morning that I was talking to Jane about and Jane, that death is more profitable than life right now, that it makes more money killing people or at least, you know, killing people to create the fear to send the other people to the things that don't work, that are killing them, remdesivir, you know, all these other different alleged ventilators.
Yes,
you know, Trump's still talking.
Yeah,
go ahead.
That they're telling this is how you get more money. I mean, are you kidding me? Something that doesn't even work?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. But I do want to say, too, when I lived in Ohio, I had this nurse practitioner, actually it was a physician assistant. I really like going to. And the thing is that with him, every time I'd ask him a question, or especially the first few times, he just looked at me like, oh, God, you're one of those. Meaning that you're just not gonna listen to what they say and say, okay, yeah, well, let me do that. Give me the whatever drug, whatever medication. Because mm-hmm. there's always other options. Well, I would say almost always other options. But
yep.
The thing is, don't be afraid, like Jane was saying, don't be afraid to ask. And if you're not getting your answers or they're really not listening, yeah, then find a different doctor. And sometimes it can be kind of tricky because some places, doctors are very hard to come by because they have their quota of patients. They're not taking any more patients. And you're like, oh, my gosh, who do you go to then?
Yeah.
But just keep ask around, ask your friends who they go to, and then try to find a different doctor that way. But, yeah, you always want to be able to go to someone where you feel that you're being validated in what you're saying and that they're willing to answer your questions. But
yeah.
Can you imagine now with all these people that are now losing their job, the medical professionals, you know
mm-hmm.
what? I would much rather have someone that's not vaccinated and qualified, well qualified in what they're doing, than someone
mm-hmm.
vaccinated and not that qualified.
Well, I almost consider people in the health professions that are vaccine injured to be unqualified simply because they got it. And now, I'm not talking about, you know, if they did it because they were forced to on a job, that's coercion. That's a little different. But the people that have denied the information that is so obvious, the studies that are out there, everything that we've talked about, and I'm not a doctor, you know, and it wasn't hard for me to look this stuff up. I mean, I'm, you know, I can read a study as well as a doctor can and look at the, well, maybe, you know, not a specialist in that particular field. But, I mean, it's not that hard to find out what percentage of the people live and percentage of the people die, you know, for a certain treatment. Like the article says here, remdesivir reveals, this is from a Natural News article, that of the 7,960 beneficiaries prescribed remdesivir for COVID-19, 2,058 of them died. That's 25.9%. That's over a quarter.
Wow.
That's not what I would call a successful treatment.
No, not at all.
Especially
when you look at something else like the hydroxychloroquine and stuff like that and how much success they're having. And people can say, oh, no, they're not. There are some doctors out there that haven't mm-hmm. lost a single COVID patient. Not
mm-hmm.
one single patient of theirs has died that had COVID. And then
mm-hmm.
you can say, well, they just haven't had the severest of the severe. I would beg
no.
to differ because I think a lot of these people, or a lot of us
yeah.
who have had COVID, I think it starts out not real severe, and then it can develop into something more severe. So
uh-huh.
I just think it's a travesty in how it's being addressed. And Fauci, he's got so much blood on his hands.
Yep.
I don't even know how he can sleep at night. I really don't. Knowing,
well, I'll tell you.
I mean, there has to be a point where money doesn't matter. It's doing the right thing, and as a doctor, do no harm. Look at how much harm he's doing. That says it all.
Well, he's
okay,
a psychopath.
Now, Bumperjack says the ethics of government action says he has to report any personal profit from vaccines. So how is he able to get away with that? My thinking is, just look at Fauci talking now. He doesn't even tell the truth when he's live on TV. How do you tell the truth about where his money comes from or goes? He's not on it.
That's funny that the Bumperjack quotes the Ethics in Government Act for Dr. Fascist. That's kind of funny, actually.
I think when he talks about unethical, it should be in the dictionary in a picture of him because he is not ethical.
Oh, of course not. No, if he were ethical, I mean, we've proved that way back with AZT in the fact that he pushed AZT because Big Pharma wanted AZT back during the AIDS crisis when there was, I forgot what the name of the drug is, these New York doctors found a drug that was much more successful in treating AIDS patients, and Fauci blocked it because AZT made more money. So again, death is more profitable, you know, than life. And it's the scariest thing that our medical profession is now geared towards medical Marxism, medical segregation, you know, ideological medicine, sustainability. That was in that CMS thing also, and health equity. These are all Marxist principles.
You know, the interesting thing is when you were talking, I was going to say that he should have been long gone. People that watched the or were around during the AIDS, all that was going on there and how he, the debacle with what he did with that. But then it comes, brings to mind that he is the exact person government wants in there because government itself is so corrupt and they have, there's so many layers in all their bureaucracies and who's making money off of what, that the false narrative and stuff like that. So he fits right in because he's one of them.
Uh-huh. Well, he's instead leading
of, yeah, yeah, instead of getting someone in there that's competent.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll do the
well,
right thing.
Show me, you know, when it comes to, we talk about experts all the time. Everybody's like waving this expert flag. Well, they're experts. Well, tell me, that, you know, when it comes to a government expert, it's amazing that the government climate experts are all in favor of this climate change nonsense. The government health experts are all in for vaccines, okay? They, first of all, government people are given their policy and they develop the evidence later, okay? You know, you look at a private doctor, because they have to treat actual patients rather than the government doctors. You know, Fauci hasn't treated a patient in maybe never. You know, there's no evidence he's actually treated anybody ever in his entire medical career. Also, he's not a virologist. He's just a basic MD. He does have a medical degree, but that's all he has. He has no specialized training of any kind. You know, there are most of the people in this country who are in the health professions are more qualified for what they do than Dr. Fascist. Okay, he is a true psychopath, and that's how he sleeps at night. And if he's such an expert, how come 700,000 people are dead? That's not what I call a rousing success rate.
Bumper Jack says now that Fauci has no power to block anything, so this isn't making sense. He's not the FDA. Look at what his policies have been.
Well, no, people are taking...
No mask. Vaccine. Oh, booster? Well, not decided yet. You know, he's talking on both sides of his mouth. Fauci doesn't know the truth if it stared him in the face. All he looks at is his own image. And what makes him look good, sound good, and can thump his chest, which he shouldn't thump his chest at all. Because, yes, with everybody that died, he's got blood on his hands, not only in this country, but around the world.
Yes. And there
because
are, and I learned
remember,
from...
Remember, he also gave the money to China, to the Wuhan virus, or to the Wuhan lab.
Mm-hmm.
And he lied
well,
about
that. Well,
this
is all engineered.
He should not yet be in his office. He should be have been fired, not even fired, charged.
Oh yeah, and all his profits and all his assets seized.
Yeah.
You know, as part of a criminal operation. Oh yeah, absolutely. I'm with you there. But Bumperjack does have a point though, that the CDC issues guidelines only. There are two problems here. One, that the CDC is issuing guidelines that are stupid and dangerous and are killing hundreds of thousands of people. But also, the people are following them when they have no reason to. Okay, we're getting into the Supreme Court here just a little bit when we get into the second hour. But the thing is that he's right. I remember our own mayor here said, I'm just following the chain of command. The CDC guidelines are like the dictates. It's like people have misperceptions. They think that because the CDC says it, they have to follow it. That's not true. They're mere suggestions. They think that the vaccine will keep them safe from COVID. That's not true. It does not prevent the spread. The only thing it does, even if it does anything at all, besides making you sick or possibly kill you, is it lessens the symptoms if you do get COVID. That's the only thing it does, and the CDC freely admits that. Dr. Fascist is not from the CDC. He's NIH, National Institutes for Health, which is basically a grant-writing agency. What they do is they take your tax dollars, they give it to their friends at big universities, okay, and then to develop.
Proof he's done that.
Oh, of course there is. Yeah. So what he does is and he's the one that does this. So he writes the grants for the universities that are in favor of him, you know, and so they take your tax dollars and do the work that private companies should be doing, but they have the research paid for. See, this is why big pharma is so profitable, because they don't have to do their own research. The universities are doing it, all right, on your tax dollar, all right. And then Dr. Fascist and the CDC and the NIH and all the other folks in government and in private industry, they buy patents. Or I think he buys the patents first because he has a deal with the universities. So he gets to buy the patents. He gets to buy the patents on the virus. He owns patents on viruses. He owns patents on vaccines. Okay. So then when he goes to Big Pharma, he actually owns the patent. So he gets to license the patent to Big Pharma. Now, Big Pharma makes billions of dollars, you know, on the actual selling of the product, but he owns the patent. Okay. So that's how he makes his money. He owns life forms, which I don't think you can do legally. He owns vaccines. He owns formulas for vaccines. Now, someone develops something different, but he owns those things. And so do a lot of other people. And that's how they make their money. All right. So this is how this all works. It's a government industrial, you know, mafia. Medical mafia is what it is. They are very dangerous people, and that's how it works. But I will give Bumperjack credit in the fact that there is, they are right. I don't know if it's male or female. Bumperjack hasn't revealed, and that's fine. But the truth is, yeah, he's right. Fauci has no power to block anything. So why do it? Just like the Supreme Court had no power to enforce Roe v. Wade. Roe v. Wade doesn't exist except for Roe and Wade. I mean, those are the only people that are involved in that case. Everybody else is doing it voluntarily. Why? I don't know. You know, we'll get into that too, because the Supreme Court can't make policy. Let me finish this article. We'll take a little break, probably play our Santa Rosa Volunteers. We're going to Jonathan Mosley a bit, but I want to set that up. So let me just finish this article.
And he has one more comment I just want to make. He just said that Fauci is a virologist who just makes recommendations. He has no power. Oh, my God.
He's not a virologist.
He thinks he has all the power in the world.
Oh, yeah. He's a little dictator. Yeah. And he's not a virologist. I looked up his resume. You know, he went to Cornell Medical School. He's a basic MD. He has no specialized training in virology, which is kind of interesting for the guy heading up the infectious diseases, you know, part of NIH. But he's a grant writer. He doesn't have to be a virologist. His job is to dish out money to his friends and buy the results, you know, buy the patents and licenses and royalties from the money that he dishes out. So you know that that's part of the deal. So the universities are saying, we'll take the money and we'll let you have the patent. And you know that's how it's working. Quid pro quo.
Yep.
So let me just finish this article here. Natural News, the one I can't put on Facebook or social media, Wednesday, September 29th, yesterday, by Mike Adams, bombshell from attorney Thomas Renz, nearly 50,000 Medicare patients died soon after getting the COVID shot. So I'm just going to read the rest of this. And it has the video there of Thomas Renz at this conference. So it's in the article. So when you go to Natural News, you'll find it, or you can go to Brighteon. And look up the same thing. Article says, in July, Attorney Renz's whistleblower, under penalty of perjury, stated that she estimated at least 45,000 people have died from the COVID-19 vaccine. I read the Jane Doe affidavit. Okay, we went over that already. So this is like third time around for those of us here at Action Radio. Article says, USA Today fact checkers and other fact checking services claimed that to be misinformation. Today's revelation solidly solidified that the Trusted News Initiative is actually the source of misinformation and propaganda, and that attorney Thomas Renz, R-E-N-Z, whistleblower, was correct all along. After proving that over 45,000 people have died from the COVID-19 vaccine, attorney Renz then moved his attention to focus on the amount of people that are being killed in American hospital by Dr. Anthony Fauci, or as I call him, Dr. Fascist, instituted protocol of remdesivir. Attorney Renz is also in possession of remdesivir death data from the medical tracking system, which I read just a few minutes ago. Okay, let's skip over that. So he asked, you know, why is this protocol in American hospitals? Does this appear, quote, safe and effective to you? And the last little bit here from LifeSite News, it says a whistleblower has provided government data documenting 48,465 deaths within 14 days, COVID-19 vaccination among Medicare patients alone, and that's according to Medical Freedom Rights Attorney Thomas Renz. So this is a combination of articles here. Let me get to the point that's the most interesting. Here we go. It says, so Thomas Renz asked the audience, do you want to know why 14 days is important? We talked about this earlier, right? Because if you die within 14 days, you're not considered vaccinated. Okay. This is according to the Center for Disease Control, the CDC. One is not considered as being, quote, vaccinated until 14 days after the completed injection regimen, raising the question of whether government authorities have been classifying these fatalities as something other than vaccination-related deaths. And that's basically it. That's how that goes. All right. So,
So the truth be known, there's probably a whole lot more people out there that have died because of the vaccines, because if you only had one of the vaccines, then you're not considered vaccinated.
Yep.
Wow.
And most people, because that's what I think, that's the whole, I think you're onto something. I think that's the whole right idea behind, I've never heard the term fully vaccinated before. So if you're not fully vaccinated, are you unvaccinated even though you've had a shot or maybe two and not had the booster? I mean, you know, and in other words, if you're not, quote, fully vaccinated and you die of the first shot, you know, with, especially within 14 days, does that mean you're not considered to in the VAERS reporting system, which is like only 1% of the deaths anyway? That's a good question. It seems to me, and tell me what you think, that when COVID was in the early stages, they bumped up the death rates from COVID as much as possible. And now in the later stages of the propaganda campaign, they're lowering the COVID deaths as much as possible and boosting their, quote, unvaccinated death rates. All this is all propaganda. Everything after the initial COVID infection, after July of 2020, it's all been propaganda. Jean.
Also, look who's now in office. They don't want it to look bad that Biden's got so many COVID deaths. Whereas when Trump was in office, it's like, oh, yeah, make him look bad.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's take a few minutes here. I want to play our piece because once we get into Jonathan and Claire, we never get a chance for a break, which is fine. That's what makes it so much fun. And then we come back in about 6-7 minutes. I will then, until Jonathan gets here, explain why I'm doing what I'm doing with the lawsuit, bringing the federal budget before the Supreme Court as unconstitutional. So we'll be right back in just a little bit. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, insights into our founding documents, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers here in Santa Rosa County, Florida. Santa Rosa Volunteers is available at their website, srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. Federalist Papers, number 5. Once again, we return to the elitist national government promoting and future Supreme Court Chief Justice John Jay. It's hard to imagine any of his court opinions were of much use, given he returns to his favorite tactic of starting with a false hypothesis, using a false comparison for evidence, and making up his predetermined conclusion with absolutely no progression of evidence to prove his case. His basic premise is that since England and Scotland formed an entire and perfect union, which is something he got from a letter by Queen Anne back in 1706 when the states were mere colonies, that we could do exactly the same here with our states. He was, in fact, modeling our oppressor to use as evidence that we can have as good a union as England and Scotland. I guess John Jay had never heard of William Wallace and the various troubles between England and Scotland over the centuries. I wonder if, like General Milley, he knew his counterpart in England. The reason this is a false comparison is that England is a monarchy and therefore irrelevant to comparison to our states under the Articles of Confederation. Their people aren't even citizens. They are subjects. Scotland has been under the thumb and control of England also for centuries, as the King of England is also the King of Scotland. So again, this is hardly a voluntary or equal union, as are the states under the Articles of Confederation. From royalcentral.co.uk comes the current title of Queen Elizabeth II, which reads, Elizabeth II, by the grace of God, of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, and of her other realms and territories, Queen, head of the Commonwealth, defender of the faith, with the style of Majesty. One has to wonder if John Jay was secretly a monarchist, and not just an elitist national government proponent. He never speaks of individual rights and only of a strong national government with a strong national defense to defend against all enemies, real or imagined. Which brings us to the false evidence and made-up conclusion. He argues that the only way the states can defend themselves is to be under a strong national government. And that is why 3 or 4 confederacies that might form without a strong constitution would make America indefensible. And yet, the colonies, before the Articles of Confederation, threw off the oppression of the British monarchy John Jay is using in Federalist No. 5 for the model for our new nation. I'm sure this did not win him converts. He repeats himself again in this paper when he writes,
It was remarked in the preceding paper that weakness and divisions at home would invite dangers from abroad, and that nothing would tend more to secure us from them than union, strength, and good government within ourselves. He doesn't define or describe the three or four confederacies he tries to convince us the states will degenerate into if the Constitution is not passed. This is directly countered by the 13 individual states at the time of this paper, which were operating rather well as one confederacy. But John Jay is convinced that he can generate the fear with this bogus argument to scare people into running to a national government for safety. Does this sound familiar to anyone? Why else would he make all this stuff up? John Jay does define one of his confederacies by saying, "The North is generally the region of strength, and many local circumstances render it probable that the most northern of the proposed confederacies would, at a period not very distant, be unquestionably more formidable than any of the others." This is rather prophetic and ironic that the Confederacy of the Civil War, formed under the very Constitution John Jay was arguing would prevent such confederacies. Jay writes that each confederacy would be as distinct nations with individual treaties with foreign nations. Of this, he said, "Hence, it might and probably would happen that the foreign nation with whom the Southern Confederacy might be at war would be the one with whom the Northern Confederacy would be the most desirous of preserving peace and friendship." He always writes of conflict that might happen, but he never acknowledges that his fears are never realized by the states while operating under the Articles of Confederation, or that the states had a mutual support and friendship pact through the Articles, such that if one state was attacked by a foreign power, the other states would immediately rush to the defense. The colonies had neither an army, a navy, nor a national government, but created a continental army and navy nonetheless, and won independence from England. This goes against the doom and gloom of Jay's imaginary scenarios of why something that is working won't work. So what exactly was John Jay talking about? Seems to me he has a predetermined conclusion in search of evidence and comparisons that don't exist. The source for the Federalist Papers is federalistpapers.org. The Anti-Federalist Papers are from selfeducatedamerican.com. The Articles of Confederation are from usconstitution.net. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers. Their website is srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. Please share this report to anyone who needs it. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with a personal recommendation and testimonial for Eric Colley, our new webmaster and marketing guru. Eric has been invaluable in upgrading our website, writeyourlaws.com. To help you with your marketing, Eric Colley offers proven, cost-effective strategies to help small businesses, startups, and nonprofits market themselves on Google Page One. You can gain thousands of followers and be far more competitive, and this is the good part, without paid advertising. Most business owners don't have the time or expertise to excel at marketing. Even fewer have the funds to hire a special employee. And you don't have to. There is a better option. Eric Colley, a consultant who uses leading-edge marketing strategies to increase your profitability at costs which are far more affordable than an advertising or marketing agency. You can be seen high up in Google's Page One. You can dominate Google's local three-pack of businesses next to the search results map. You can be trusted as much as personal recommendations from family and friends. You can increase foot and website traffic. You can do all this, all without paying Google, Facebook, or Instagram one red cent. Eric Colley can be reached at 208-999-7510. That's 208-999-7510. His website is besmallbusiness.com. That's besmallbusiness.com. B-E-S-M-A-L-L-B-U-S-I-N-E-S-S. besmallbusiness.com. And you can reach him by email at eric@besmallbusiness.com. And that's how you do it.
Action Radio. Dangerously cool. All right. Well, I've been busy with the productions again. So we have a new commercial. And so if you are a sponsor of Action Radio, I can do the same for you. And so so feel free. And so we do it all here. We make our own commercials. We do, you know, you name it, we can do it. So we'll get Jean back as soon as she can come back. I won't find out what's happening here. But I want to spend a few minutes. Jean, I don't know if I've asked you about our latest founding moments report. Any revelations, any new things that you've discovered listening? Because I discover things all the time with the Federalist Papers or even the Anti-Federalist Papers that I didn't even know, you know, much about. I knew they existed, but I never really read them until I started doing these founding moments. Any reaction to that at all?
Yeah, I mean, I have not know, or didn't know a lot about my history that I learned in school. So much of it I've forgotten. So I think it's really neat. Before you continue, Lumberjack put a whole lot on the chat about Fauci, and he's never just a regular MD, and everything that he's done that he got off the internet. The thing is, it doesn't mean a thing, because Fauci to me is still corrupt. He's, I don't want to say a liar, but I believe he is, but I don't want to put that in someone else's mind. But I think with this whole COVID has shown how ruthless he is and how he just wants to spread his agenda. And you can read it if you want. But
oh, I've got it right here in front of me.
Yeah,
this,
just
this
the
is
mess
kind of,
he made with the AIDS stuff, it's like, no, no. And what I've read about him and what he's done with colleges and when they don't want to follow his, what, you know, how he gives his money out, I just think that's disgusting as well. It's like that,
okay.
He's as corrupt as the day is long.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, I mean, he's not an immunologist.
To follow his agenda.
You know, if you want to get, I mean, I suppose we could post his medical degree, but Bumperjack, just do some basic research on Dr. Fascist and take a look, and you'll find his Cornell medical degree, but you can't find anywhere that he's listed as a virologist, because he's not, all right? He's always been a researcher. Well, I mean, I'm a researcher, you know. As after completing medical residency in 1968, God, I was young then, Fauci joined the National Institute of Health as a clinical associate. What's that? Secretary? In the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, Laboratory of Clinical Investigation.
And he's worked for government ever since.
Exactly. He's been head of the Clinical Physiology Section.
He should have been long gone.
Well, yeah, of course. You know, and then we've got immunoregulation. So he's a bureaucrat. He's a regulation writer.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny, actually. I've got more important things to do. So let me talk about something that is purely Action Radio. You're not going to hear this anywhere else, you know, on the planet, simply because this is Action Radio first. And what I want to do, and I'm going to talk to Jonathan about this, you know, when he comes on about 7 or 8 minutes, is I want to bring a case to the Supreme Court that sues the Congress for basically authorizing and funding an unconstitutional federal budget. Okay, this is groundbreaking. This has never been done. Trust me, I looked. All right. And so nobody would even think of doing this. And, of course, the first reaction from everybody is, well, they're never going to rule on that. They're never going to rule that. And people are like, you know, folks, I don't think people understand how I think. You know, I mean, they talk about Trump thinking in chess, three-dimensional chess. Well, you know, I got news for you. I do, too. Okay. So the first reason I do this is public education. All right. Most people don't know that the federal budget is unconstitutional. All right. They certainly don't know that it's 75% unconstitutional. So the reason I went over that so carefully in the first hour yesterday was in preparation for today. So if you want to get the full impact of what we're talking about, you got to go to yesterday's show, listen to that. And because everything here is cumulative, these shows are sequential. They're not individual. You know, what we do here at Action Radio is not, you know, a single episode thing. Like most talk shows, you can take most talk shows as individual and, you know, and mostly, you know, replaceable with others. You can't do that here because so much of what we do is cumulative. And so you really have to, you really want to be here every day that you can and to keep up with what's going on. So the first reason for bringing this lawsuit is public education. All right. Nobody even thinks about the fact that the federal budget is unconstitutional. All right. We're in a situation now, and we talked about this yesterday too, where everybody's saying we have to raise the debt ceiling. We have to raise the debt ceiling. We have to pay our obligations. And I proved over and over and over that if you lower your obligations, you don't have to raise the debt ceiling. It's just that simple. Okay. What Congress does is they authorize the expenditure of money that they don't have. Well, then they have to borrow money to pay for that expenditure. Well, when they're under the debt ceiling, then they have to raise the debt ceiling to authorize the money to pay for the thing that they already voted for. Okay. That's not, and they call that an obligation. We have to do that to meet our obligations. Well, no, you don't. You have to change your obligations. And it's so very simple. It's so logical that the whole point of a debt ceiling is it's actually a ceiling. So you need to spend less money. You need to borrow less money than is the debt ceiling, okay? Because the debt ceiling is a debt ceiling, okay? So that's what we need to talk about. Here's, the next thing is that this is such an obviously open and shut case. You can't argue. Nobody can argue that the federal budget is constitutional according to Article 1, Section 8. You can't. It's impossible. So, but they're going to do it anyway, and I'm just curious to see how. That's going to be so much fun. You probably get things like, well, we can't deny the Social Security system. People have paid into that for years and years, but it's unconstitutional. Okay. Well, we can't deny Medicare. It's been going for years and years, and now it's Marxist medical care. We just talked about that with Jane Addams in the Medical Freedom Report. Well, we can't, we have to fund illegal aliens because they're here. Nonsense. So it's going to be, and you're racist. Oh, you know, that's going to be next. You know, when they run out of things to say, they're going to accuse me of racism, right? So this is what's going to happen. So it's going to be so funny to watch if we can actually do that. And the other thing that's going to be interesting to watch are various organizations, the Heritage Foundation, Cato, the Hoover Institute, all these legal foundations, all these allegedly constitutional lawyers and conservatives that believe in, truth, justice, the American way, mom, apple pie, and the flag. Okay. Let's see if they really do. Let's see who backs us. Let's see who goes to the court with us. Let's see who brings on the friend of the court briefs, okay, that go along with us. That's how we're going to find out who the real conservatives are, who the real patriots are, by who supports this lawsuit. Is it a litmus test, as they say? Yes, you bet it is. So I went to the website, and I thought to myself, well, how do I get a case to the Supreme Court? So I found an article called How Can I Get My Case to the Supreme Court, which is very nice, by the law firm of Dewey, Cheatham & Howe. No, I'm just kidding. Sheen, Brandenburg, and Schrope, Federal Criminal Law Center. You can call or text 404-633-3797 and tell them that you support the lawsuit against the Supreme Court, even though I haven't written the lawsuit against the federal budget, even though I haven't written it yet, but I will. So this is November 23rd, 2016, by Marsha Sheen. I guess she's one of the partners. Yeah, she's probably the lead partner because her name's first. And she says, Marbury versus Madison, Dred Scott versus Sanford, Plessy versus Ferguson, Brown versus Board of Education are all cases that have shaped history. Those are all infamous cases, by the way. They're pretty horrible. Except Brown versus Board of Education, that was a good one. All right. Are all cases that have shaped history and were all heard by the Supreme Court of the United States. Let me get my good voice here. The Supreme Court of the United States is the highest federal court in the country. A ruling by this court will hold over federal jurisdiction only unless that same court overturns it. Okay, that's total BS. That's complete nonsense. Okay, first of all, the court doesn't make rulings, they issue opinions. Okay, they're not binding, except on the parties involved. They're binding on the parties involved. Roe v. Wade was binding on Roe and Wade. I mean, that's what the court does. They make a ruling for the party, but they issue opinions for everything else. Okay, they can't make regulations, they can't make policy, they can't make law. Even though they do. That's what Marbury versus Madison was all about. And that's why that's wrong. But let's get to the main issue. But how does a case get to the Supreme Court? And that's the next sentence. So it says parties must first petition the court for a writ of certiorari, the most fancy Latin terms that I'm going to get Jonathan to define here, or asking the court to hear their case. I guess that's what it means, asking the court to hear the case. The first requirement is that the court must have jurisdiction to hear the case. Well, I think anything that the Congress does is jurisdiction of the Supreme Court, being one of the other branches of government. In fact, those are the cases that are the greatest jurisdiction of the Supreme Court are the things that arise in the other main branches. That would be the legislative, which is Congress, the executive, which is the president, and the judicial, which is the Supreme Court. So that would be what they call original jurisdiction. In other words, they get the case first. It doesn't have to go to a lower court. You're not going to send the federal budget to a lower court. It's going to go right to the Supreme Court. So I would argue that two types of jurisdiction, original and appellate. Appellate's when it starts in the lower court and works its way up on appeal, against the Supreme Court. I would argue that just like the Texas election case against the other states, this is original jurisdiction. So it's going to go right to the Supreme Court, see if it gets there at all. It says these are cases that involve disputes between the states or disputes arising among ambassadors and other high-ranking ministers. Well, I think the senators and the representatives of Congress, they'd be considered high-ranking ministers, right? Anyway, next, the case can be appealed to the Supreme Court from the appellate federal court or state court. Okay, we're not going to worry about that. We're going to go directly to the Supreme Court. However, here are the qualifiers. However, simply because these elements are meant does not guarantee that the, simply because these elements are met, you misprinted there, folks, and your lawyers too, you should learn to look at your language better. Anyway, just because the elements are met does not guarantee that the Supreme Court will hear the case. When a case is filed with the Supreme Court, it will first enter a pool of Supreme Court clerks, who will review all the documents, create a summary, and include a recommendation on whether or not the court shall take the case. What, you mean we got minions deciding this? We got little twiddlies out there deciding what cases the Supreme Court justices will even look at? See, this is the problem I'm always having, you know, trying to get us known, you know, with all the large public figures in this country, is that my emails go to minions. They go to clerks. They go to people that have no concept of what we're doing here, the potential power of Action Radio. So the reason I can't get to the people that I want to get to, the Newt Gingriches, Mike Huckabees, you know, the President Trump himself, the lawful president, the reason I can't get to them is all my emails go to minions. They go to clerks. And they have no idea what I'm talking about. They probably think I'm some kind of idiot out here. They don't realize the potential of a citizen legislative revolution. I do. They don't. Have you run into that? The world is run by clerks and minions.
Yeah, well, you know, it's true. Pretty much everybody has someone, you know, underneath them that does all their day-to-day stuff, and that includes, you know, correspondence, emails, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we just have to get around that. Okay. Factors the court considers when choosing cases. This is conflict of law. The United States judicial system consists of 50 state Supreme Courts and 13 federal circuits. Oftentimes, these courts will reach different decisions concerning federal or constitutional law. Yeah, the Ninth Circuit, the one out there in California, is famous for doing really stupid stuff. Actually, it's interesting that the Ninth Circuit is right there next to the mayors or some other big offices. They're all in like one section of San Francisco. You got City Hall, you got the Supreme Court. Oh, it's the California Supreme Court. It's right there next to City Hall. It's kind of funny. The Ninth Circuit, well, I'll figure out where they're located. We'll worry about it later. Anyway, it says that these courts reach different conclusions, which is why they're appealed, which is why they make their way up. So conflict of law. Yes, this is a conflict of law. It meets that test. The fact that Article 1, Section 8 has certain specific things, which I went over yesterday in excruciating detail, proves that the federal budget is 75% unconstitutional. Second issue, important social issue. Sometimes the case is so unusual or important to the times that the Supreme Court will decide to hear it. Examples of this occurring are U.S. versus Nixon, Bush v. Gore, Roe v. Wade. How about, Action Radio versus Congress? I don't know what we call it. Is this an important social issue? Well, considering the federal budget affects literally everybody, yes, I think this is an important social issue. Okay. Next test, and an interest important to the justice. Oftentimes, a case will come about that speaks to the interest of a justice, such as women's rights or environmental control. Here, the justice will vote to hear the case in order to decide an issue close to them. Well, let me see. Considering the federal budget includes a budget for the Supreme Court itself, I would think that they might have a modest interest in whether the money that they're taking from the government is constitutional or not. If not, I'm going to ask them anyway. And the last one, when lower courts disagree. Well, because we're going directly to the Supreme Court, this isn't really an issue. But it says that this is different from conflict of law cases. This occurs when lower courts go against a previous Supreme Court decision. The court may want to hear the case to correct the lower court or to simply overrule the case, which they can do because of the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court can overrule any other court. But I find it interesting that they talk about an important social issue, Roe v. Wade. Wasn't that a health issue, as they say? Anyway, conflict of law, important social issue, and interest important to the justice, and when lower courts disagree. Those are the tests in this article. Gene, what do you think so far?
Makes sense, yeah.
So do you think we can take on the Congress, the entire federal budget? Do you think this is going to be a rather interesting case to file? Do you think we're going to get any media attention other than us? Do you think that will be labeled a wacko, a racist, who knows what I am? But I just think this would be a fascinating thing to pursue just to see what happens. And I'll do it just for that reason, just for my own amusement, if nothing else. But I think that this is critically important, that something that is this out of whack with the Constitution is probably the thing that's most out of whack in the entire government is the federal budget, you know, being out of whack with it, being, you know, unconstitutional. It's probably the greatest unconstitutionality, if you can put a value on that kind of thing, in our entire government. What's more out of whack than the federal budget?
Yeah, I think if nothing else, it'll make people more aware that, hey, we're not going to take it anymore, which I think is very important.
Mm-hmm. That's goal number one, public yes. education. The number one reason I'm doing this is public education, so that people know, first of all, they can follow through how this filing goes. I mean, that's going to be important. But secondly, that I think people have no idea how unconstitutional the federal budget actually is. I'm going to do a little Facebook check. If you have a comment, I'm going to see if I can I want Jonathan on board here. I want to find out where he's going where he is. Let's see what's happening here. Jonathan, where are you? Oh, he sent me something. Okay, Jonathan, where are you? Call it. You know, what am I going to do? I might ask you, at some point I ask you to call our guests. Oh, there he is. Here I was just thinking about that too. So there is our legal expert. Hopefully he was listening to all this. Well, I'll find out in a second. Let me play his theme. I think it's the longest theme, but I think it's the best theme. And it really gets us in the mood to talk law. It probably started with an episode of Perry Mason many years ago, that yearning to understand the law so that you can help people who don't understand the law. The arguments, the debates, the mental trial beyond the actual trial, all the while trying to do the best you can for your client. He walks the halls of justice, pictures on the wall of great minds who advance the law. He walks not in the black robes of the judge, but the suit and tie of the attorney. Known as counselor, lawyer, or any number of other names, and after years of hard work, these are the people accepted to the bar and allowed to practice law, especially at trial. For it is at trial, many times, that the great decisions of our society are realized. It's where the laws get tested. It's where juries have lost their power to judge the laws and not just the facts. It's where judges make up their own law, especially through interpretations. But if you are ever in trouble, your attorney can be your best friend. We are privileged at Action Radio to have one of those practitioners of the law, someone who knows the Constitution, who knows about due process, who takes the rights of the individual as sacred and will fight for them with all he's got. It is at this time every week that we immerse ourselves in the law. So join us in the law as we go to the Action Radio Legal Report with Jonathan Mosley. Good morning, Jonathan.
Good morning.
I want to check and see how much you've heard so far about my quest, my crusade to take the federal budget before the Supreme Court and have it ruled unconstitutional. Did you get a chance to listen to any of the show this morning? I know you're a busy guy.
In fact, I had to pay my bill. Sorry, but I looked That's over okay. what my phone bill. But, you know, I'm not sure that how you propose to do that, because I'm not sure where to go today, but mm-hmm. you know, it seems to me that basically our country is a fake for 100 years or more, mm-hmm. and we plan to provide these things. So I'm a little, what's the basis, if you could say again, the basic legal hook that you want to,
okay.
to bring
well,
to that?
Let me give you a little background. It started actually several years ago when Dr. Walter Williams, economics professor and director of the economics program at George Mason University, was on the show. And we got to talking about things about the economy, about everything else. And I asked him about how much of the budget is constitutional. I still got the recording. I can supply that. I might post that again. And he talked about how much was constitutional. Basically, defense, the interstate highway system, and the offices of the federal government. And I said, it's not a very big percentage of the budget, is it? And he says, no, it's not. Well, mostly it's defense. So it came out to be a rough figure is $1 trillion for that. And I said, well, how much money do these folks take in? Well, about $4 trillion. So wait a minute. So you got a $3 trillion surplus outside the Constitution? Yeah, about that. So I said, wait a minute. Well, let's find out how this works. So I asked him, about his PhD candidates, if they could actually go through Article 1, Section 8, the various clauses of Article 1, Section 8, which I did yesterday in the first hour, and as I said, in excruciating detail, because it got boring for me. But I think it was essential to do that so people understand what we're talking about. Anyway, and I asked if his PhD candidates would go through the federal budget and find out the things that match with the clauses of Article 1, Section 8, and find out the exact amount of money that's constitutional. Well, they didn't want to do it, so I did. So I literally went through the Constitution. I wrote an article of this, which I published, in Canada Free Press back in, I think it was 2017 I wrote this. Yeah, it would have been after Dr. Williams was on the show. And then I made a video about it, and I put both of these on Facebook. I think I've sent them both to you. And so when you get a chance to take a look at those, you'll see what I'm talking about. But then I thought, I had this revelation. It's like, you know me, it's Action Radio. We can't just get the information out. We have to do something. Well, I thought, what the hell can I do with this? Well, if it's unconstitutional, the place where you get that resolved is the Supreme Court. Now, no one's ever done this, of course. I know I looked. But why can't I take, if the federal budget is that unconstitutional, it's basically 75% unconstitutional. And that includes Social Security, Medicare, all the entitlements, all this kind of stuff. All the things we talk about is unconstitutional. But if it's unconstitutional, we can take it to the court. So there are three reasons I want to do this. And we can go back over these individually. In fact, I had this article I just went over just before you came on called How Can I Get My Case to the Supreme Court? And it's by Sheen, Brandenburg, and Schrope, which is on my Facebook page and in the Action Radio group for public folks. And I just went over the tests and things, and I can go over a little bit of that again. My reasons for doing this are three. The first reason, I just talked to Gene about this, public education. All right? Most people don't know how unconstitutional the federal budget really is. Okay, I believe this would be original jurisdiction because it involves the Congress passing an unconstitutional budget. So we're basically taking the Congress to the Supreme Court. Now, I'm not a big believer in the Supreme Court, but I'd be really interested to see if they would issue an opinion saying that the federal budget is unconstitutional, or would they go over which parts of it are unconstitutional. I mean, this could be fascinating. This could be a whole revelation in citizen action. So the first thing is public education, to have people realize that most of what the government does, three-quarters of it, they can't do, not constitutionally anyway. The second reason for doing this is that it is so obviously an open and shut case. I want to see what the court's going to do. Okay, they may reject it completely, in which case we mount a huge campaign to try and get it in the court. I want to get Larry Klayman. I want to get Judicial Watch. I want to get Heritage Foundation, get them away from their luncheons, martinis, and overpriced guest speakers to actually do something. You know, Cato, Hoover Institute, legal institutes, Pacific Legal, Southeastern Legal, the Ed Meese organizations, all the different Heartland Foundation, all these folks that allegedly are conservative foundations, think tanks, Claremont Institute, Rutherford Institute. I could go on all day. I want to get in touch with these people and say, will you help us in our case before the Supreme Court? And let's see who our friends are and who they aren't. But the thing is, this is so obviously unconstitutional. They can't rule other than that. There's no way they can rule other than the federal budget is unconstitutional because it's so clearly unconstitutional. All you have to do is look at the size of it. Look at the agencies that aren't in Article 1, Section 8. Look at the things that I mentioned, education, health, energy, EPA. I mean, I could go on and on and on. Most of what they have there are not Social Security and Medicaid. There are no entitlements in Article 1, Section 8. So it's so obviously an open and shut case that they can't possibly issue an opinion other than the federal budget is unconstitutional, or at least 75% of it is. But they're going to do that. They're going to find a way to weasel around it, and that in itself is going to be interesting. So I want to see how these folks weasel around the fact that there's an unconstitutional budget. No one has ever brought this before the Supreme Court. No one's even thought of doing it, as far as I know. But I want to do it, and I need your help to do it. I want to file whatever I need to file. I mean, you know this kind of stuff. And I'd love to argue this case myself before the Supreme Court, if they let me. If not, let's get someone who can – maybe Larry can argue it. I don't know. What do you think? That's what I want to do.
Well, I mean – most of what the government does and is unconstitutional. Most
right.
of what the courts do is unconstitutional. Most of what the courts allow is unconstitutional.
Mm-hmm.
But they do it. So, mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not sure I mean, so, you know, I'm pretty, I mean, it's not that those arguments are wrong. It's that I think that they're not going to pay attention to them. And I think they may, you know, I think that they probably have been challenged.
I couldn't find a case. Yeah, I couldn't find a case.
Yeah.
I looked, but I mean, there might be. I mean, I just couldn't find it, which means, you know, if you can find it, that's great. The verdict from the Supreme Court is the least of my concerns. Even having them hear the case, is lower on my priority list. Okay. The main things I'm looking at are public education and building knowledge with the people of how the government works, and then finding out which groups are truly conservative and true patriots. You know, maybe I think the Tea Party might help us, for example. You know, I mean, there's a lot of people out there, and the fact that conservatives are screaming for a way to fight for our freedom. Well, this is the way you can fight for your freedom. Get the federal budget before the Supreme Court. I think this could be a fascinating challenge. I think Action Radio can lead it. I think we need a big story by somebody important, you know, out there. It'd be nice to Sebastian Gorka or Mark Levin say, hey, we're going to sue the Supreme Court over the federal budget. I mean, I have contacts sort of peripherally, but maybe I can get those folks to do something. I mean, I've written Gorka. He's not crazy about me right now. I'll tell that story sometime. But yeah. Let's. I want to pursue this. I want to know. I want to know where the paperwork is. What do I have to do? Who do I have to file it with? I want the nuts and bolts of how to do this. And then we'll publish our filing form thing.
Yeah. Well, in federal court, it's not that hard. It does cost you a $400 filing fee, but
I'll find a sponsor. I'll get a sponsor.
You know, the courts think that they have decided this, which means they dodged it, made excuses for not following the Constitution. If an attorney, especially me, were to file it,
right,
they'll sanction me as they have, you know, for a frivolous lawsuit.
They'll sanction you? Oh, well, then I'll file it on behalf of Action Radio.
Yeah. So I mean that's what I'm saying is that, you know, so there's that, and then there's I think you would have to file it in the district court now, and this is some one of the things we've heard with many of Trump's or the lawsuits involving Trump or whatever.
Uh-huh.
Something that is constitutional or requiring a new set of laws. I mean, look, you know, if the courts were as hostile. You know, if you go to court and the judge doesn't like it, they'll be all offended. Like, okay, you see this building all around us? This is here for lawsuits. You know, they act like you're offending them that you filed a lawsuit. You know, this is what the building is here for. This is why you have a job. This is why they hired you, is to hear lawsuits. But
right.
They act like, you know, you were through a skunk through their window because you filed a lawsuit.
Mm-hmm.
But the expectation is that, you know, you're laying it out in a way that you want, you're going to go up on appeal. And,
Why wouldn't this go right to the Supreme Court? Because it involves the Congress. I would think this would come under original jurisdiction.
The Supreme Court doesn't want, the Supreme Court doesn't hear things originally. They want it to go, they want someone else to find all the facts first, and then they just sit back and think about it.
This is the Congress. A district court isn't at the level of the Congress is one of the three main branches of government. Wouldn't it take another main branch of government to deal with it?
No, they do it all the time. I mean,
but
this ultimately will go to court.
But that's not an excuse. I'm not blaming you, and I'm not mad at you. I mean, I don't want to say that. But what I'm saying is the fact that this is being done does not make – I mean, segregation was done for a long time, too. It doesn't mean it was right. You know, and this is – and I'm not equating the two. But it's still wrong.
But it's just that the trial – the way this got it set up is a trial, you know – you know, original lawsuits start in the lower courts.
Okay.
Uh, So it's they're in appellate court. They're not. There's only very rare exceptions. It'd be like when now if you got a state to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Now you know if a state were bringing a lawsuit, which they should, then it would be an original case in the Supreme. Although again, they even though it says they have original jurisdiction, again, you know everything is malarkey in America, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And we've allowed to get this way because we wanted to believe that the government was good and the government was there to help us and the government cares about us. So no question that a lawsuit between states is original jurisdiction in the Supreme Court. But as we saw with the election count, the Supreme Court says, well, you know, yeah, but what if we don't want to? You know, the it's very clear in the Constitution that they have original jurisdiction. But they've made so many exceptions for themselves. And mm-hmm. they say, well, that doesn't mean we have to do it if we don't want to. So it's clear, yes, they have to. It's in the Constitution. They're the ones who do it. And yet they've made up these loopholes to say, yeah, but what if we don't want to do it? So we'll just decide not to do it. And that's what they did with the lawsuit by Pennsylvania and 19 other states against this, mm-hmm. against the election. Mm-hmm. It's undeniably clear that they have original jurisdiction, unless they just decide that now we don't feel like it. If you want to do it and get attention, you could try it there. It would cost your filing fee. They'd probably kick you out, but they'd look bad doing it. And
now you're talking.
Yep.
No, I'd build a coalition. I'd want to see what other organizations would be interested in doing that. Maybe One American News will be a party to the suit. I mean, that would be fascinating.
Well,
maybe Freedom Watch. Maybe who knows? And I don't think Heritage will, because,
right.
like I say, we got to drag them away from their lunch tables. But there's a legal foundation. Chris Ann Hall, for example. Who knows?
Right. But the thing is that this is what's happening in our country, is that the empire is fighting back. And we're not necessarily winning in the immediate sense, but everybody is seeing that this whole thing is mm-hmm. is crap. I mean, the American people are getting educated. They're not going to take it anymore.
Yeah.
So that's why this is such a good time to do it. Huh?
That's why this is such a good time to do it. See, I think we've timed Action Radio perfectly, because people are furious. And every time, the thief in chief Biden, makes another proclamation or another dictate, he infuriates even more people. He's reversed everything Trump did right. He has no idea what's happening. He won't answer questions. He's just, roaming the halls aimlessly, from what I've heard from different reports in the White House. No one knows what he's doing. He's being handled completely, and people are sick of it. They're doing, FU Biden in all the stadiums right now. And he got booed last night. There was a big report on that. You didn't hear that in the mainstream news, but he went to some baseball stadium and got booed. Nobody likes him.
Right.
And conservatives and patriots and independents and libertarians want to do something. They just don't know how. There's no direction. There's no direction for the Patriot movement to go and do something like there was in the Tea Party. Taxed enough already. That's what TEA stands for, Tea Party. Taxed enough already. Most people don't know that. But this, I think, would be a fabulous rallying cry. What do you think?
It could be. But like I say, what you don't understand is that for example, how bad mm-hmm. is a judge? The lawyers are not allowed to tell you.
Yeah.
The rules are that a judge cannot, a lawyer cannot disparage a judge.
Mm-hmm.
So the people who actually know.
I'm a private citizen.
I have gotten in trouble
right.
for a private email asking for prayer. that did not mention a judge, but described the judge and asked for prayer because my client knew that his mother-in-law had a habit of bribing people.
Well, that's interesting.
And
but the but,
mention the judge.
Yeah, but here's what I want to try. All right, go ahead.
Well, but let me say that the one of the problems are, and I'm, you know, I'm sorry to be this way, but you know, everybody listening who cares, you waited too long. I'm sorry, but that's just the reality. I mean, I'm not saying we give up on our country, but the fact is that the American people let it get far worse than you could possibly imagine, because we, you know, and my mom was in, you know, Eagle Forum way back when. And, you know, and all these in the 70s and the 60s were warning everybody and like, oh, no, that'll never happen. And they were right. And 99% of the American people just went about their lives and didn't pay attention. And so now we're in, you know, everything that was predicted, everything like people are saying today, I can't believe it's, you know, this, that, and the other thing. You were warned.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry to say that, you know, and I don't mean to say that as a bad thing, but the thing is, if we don't recognize this, there's no way to undo it until people understand it.
Yeah.
And the thing is that, you know, basically the American people slept while the thieves robbed your house. And so the thing is, and the problem is that I can't do that because they can take away my livelihood. And I'd love to have I'd love to not need it, but.
No, I understand.
Well,
I'm not asking you to do something that's going to jeopardize your livelihood, but I want to really emphasize this for you and Gene and everybody who's listening and whoever gets the podcast later on, that the reason I'm doing this has very little to do with the verdict. In fact, it has almost nothing to do with the verdict because I know what the verdict's going to be. They're probably not going to take the case. That's not why I'm doing this.
But I mean, you can do that. I can't.
Okay, well, that's what, okay. So all I'm asking you to do is to tell me how. Get me the forms. I'll find the $400. You know, maybe I'll do a GoFundMe. You know, I don't know. Or we've got sponsors. I'm working on more sponsors, too. I bet you I can come up with the money to do that. But the thing is, I want to file it, and then the real challenge is going to be getting people to support this and get some friend of the court briefs. Because here's what's going to happen. The first reaction of people is the Supreme Court's never going to go along with it. Then I have to go through the same explanation again, but that's not the point. Why are you filing it if you don't want to get a verdict? Again, public education, you know, watching them squirm out of an obviously open and shut case, and let's see who our friends are. Let's see who are the real patriots out there. That's why I'm doing it.
Well, and it's true that the reason we're in such a mess, we're in such a flytrap, it's because we didn't do anything all these years.
Okay. Well,
so
I can't change that.
Stood up,
but I can change this.
You people.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's not. It's. You know, we do need to fight back, and we need to fight back in large numbers.
Right.
And you know, we can't. You know, the thing is, we're not going to unravel something like this with a couple people doing it. It's got to be. You know, it's the whole country has to rise up, and that's the thing. That in fact, I was starting to think about what, you know, there wasn't a strong legal case on my mind or things that I wanted to talk about, but what I'm seeing, and I don't know if we have time or whatever, is,
well, we got some time before Claire gets here, and I have a case I want to talk to you about, which is the Arizona audit. I want to get
what
to that,
it?
But I got tons of things on that. I want to check our live chat first, just to see. We have a new we have live chat. So anybody, if you want to join us on live chat, we got nothing on this. So we have a new person. Bumperjack5 is our latest keyboard warrior, and so I'm really glad they're there because they're providing all kinds of interesting stuff for us to talk about. So if anybody wants to join us on live chat, that's Gene's baby. So feel free to she'll be the first person talk to on live chat. Yeah. Can I
doing that now?
We're doing it right now. Yeah, it's open right now. I guess people don't find this as interesting as they did when I went after Dr. Fascist, the genocidal psychopathic vaccine drug pusher. But here's what's going on. The Arizona audit, something happened that was fabulous. Wendy Rogers.
Let me interrupt.
Oh, yeah, please go ahead. Yeah, no, go ahead.
A couple. One is that in most cases, a taxpayer does have jurisdiction. I mean, it varies by state, and it's a little tricky, but spending is something that the federal government, and more so some of the state governments, has recognized that you have standing as a taxpayer. At least they've done it like for violations of church and state, which of course doesn't exist in the Constitution. But
look at the medical exemptions. We're talking about a violation of church and state. The fact that they're denying medical exemptions or religious exemptions for the vaccine—that's definitely where church and state have crossed over with the religion, the religious cult of Fauci, you know, the vaccine thing, and the fact that they're denying religious exemptions when they can't do that. Yeah, we should talk about that too. Anyway, go ahead.
You do have taxpayer standing, and specific things are unconstitutional is a stronger lawsuit than I thought. Just the dollar total, I thought maybe if it's
no. Listen to the first hour, because what I've done, and here's the thing, I did this in both an article, I did this both in a video. We actually take Article 1, Section 8, and I go through every clause, and I go through the federal budget, and I go through the Congressional Research Service, and I go through various sources. I go through websites of the various government departments. I use about 30 or 40 sources to put this. This is a big project to put this together. This took me several weeks, all right?
There is an argument that Nancy Pelosi is saying we have to raise the debt limit because of the full faith and credit clause.
Nope. That's a lie. That is a huge lie. We went over that too. Gene's like, yeah, I heard this already.
But the other side of it might be that it's unconstitutional to do a deficit spending because it impairs the full faith and credit.
No, I wouldn't say so. Yeah. I would be curious about that because, Article 1, Section 8, Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare. There's a place it says to borrow money on the credit of the United States. So Congress has the power to borrow money. So the question is, I consider what they're doing economic treason, the debt ceiling. But what they don't have, where the argument falls flat, is, and I explained this yesterday, but let me do it again because, people listen on different days and different times. Congress, as you know, will appropriate money. They will spend money on something. Let's say $5 trillion on the Green New Deal, which is what this latest thing coming out of Congress is. Well, they don't have $5 trillion in the budget right now to cover that. Okay, they have to borrow money to pay for that. All right. So, but they can't borrow $5 trillion because it runs into the debt ceiling. So what they're saying is that they voted for, they passed the Green New Deal, $5 trillion in spending. Okay, which means that the Treasury has to come up with the money. They either have to print it, borrow it, or something like that. But they can't borrow it because of the debt ceiling. So what they have to do is raise the debt ceiling to cover it. And they say that we have to raise the debt ceiling to pay for this obligation. Well, that's BS because all they have to do is pass another bill getting rid of that obligation. Okay, you cancel the Green New Deal, but they don't want to do that because Nancy Pelosi said it's not about dollars. It's about values. It's our values that are important. The dollars don't matter. And Biden and his absent-minded absurdity, which everybody seems to be picking up on, is that this $5 trillion Green New Deal is going to cost $0. Well, that's intellectually impossible. You can't spend $5 trillion and have it cost no dollars. I mean, that's irrational. But yet that's what they're saying. And if it costs $0, then why are they raising the debt ceiling? Okay, so the contradictions are everywhere, right? So the simple answer is cut spending. If you have a debt ceiling, the way you meet the debt ceiling and maintain the full faith and credit of the United States, the way you maintain credit at all, is you lower your spending. You can't call up your credit company and say, look, I've already bought, a brand new 1960 vintage Fender Stratocaster guitar. It cost me $50,000. Let's make it a good one. $50,000. Yet my credit limit is only, $10,000. So I'm raising my credit limit. Okay, you are now going to pay for my Fender $50,000 Fender 1960 Stratocaster guitar. Okay, that's what Congress is effectively saying. They're raising their own debt limit. They're raising their own credit limit. You know, like if you, and if everybody did this with the credit card companies, imagine that. And we went over this example yesterday. If everybody in the country had the ability to raise their credit limit and not pay the bill, and just keep borrowing more money, you know, the credit system would collapse. Those companies would go bankrupt in a very short period of time, which is what's going to happen in our country if we keep this going.
That's why I thought the argument was that the Congress has the power to borrow money, but if they borrow so much money as to impair the credit worthiness of the United States, it might come to a point where it's unconstitutional.
That's an interesting point. I don't know. I got to think that through. I got to kind of work it through my brain for a while. My argument is that all they have to do is this. In other words, they're putting the cart before the horse. They're saying, this is what we want to spend money on. Therefore, we have to raise the debt ceiling, which is what, where they should be saying, we don't have the money for this program. Therefore, we can't authorize it. That would be the proper way to do it through appropriations committees, budget hearings, the normal budgeting process. This would never come about, but they don't do that anymore. They budget by wishful thinking, you know, because it's their values. So they don't even care about the dollars. The Democrats are so irrational at this point that they're so into their Marxism that they don't care about the economy and hyperinflation and destruction of the economy. They don't care. They don't even think about it. They don't see it. They're blind to the economic treason and economic suicide that they're putting us on. So the only way out of this, quite honestly, is to take away their obligations. Now, the Republicans are not authorizing the debt ceiling raise, but they're doing it for all the wrong reasons. They're doing it to punish the Democrats or force the Democrats to take the blame when the economy collapses. But the problem is the economy is going to collapse. What they should be doing is saying, we're going to cut these obligations. You know, the Cooley's formula, half the budget, half the national debt has to go. That's what I'm advocating, the Cooley's plan. Because Calvin Coolidge did it, the result was the Roaring Twenties. What we really need is the Roaring Twenties again. And then when we get the Roaring Twenties again 100 years later is to do what Coolidge did. We have to cut the budget in half. We have to cut the national debt in half. And the only way you can do that is by drastically reducing spending to a constitutional level. In other words, 25% of what it is now, a little over $1 trillion, and take that $3 to $4 trillion surplus above what's legally able to be spent on the Constitution, put that into reducing the national debt. You know, let's say $3 trillion a year, national debt's $30 trillion. We could eliminate the national debt in 10 years under this program. Constitutional budget, surplus goes to the national debt, we're done in 10 years. That's the solution.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think saying that the categories are unconstitutional is perhaps a stronger argument.
Well,
So go ahead.
Social Security, Medicaid. They're unconstitutional. All the entitlements are unconstitutional.
All right. So go if you have to go to your other the call-in.
We're fine.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
It's just us for now. Claire's going to join us in the next 10 minutes. Well, let me just leave that for now, and let's talk off the air more and see how we can actually do the filing, and then we'll talk about that on the show. But there's something I want to go over to in the last 10 minutes before Claire gets here, and this is this memorandum for the record. So what happened is we've been over, again, in great detail, the results of the Arizona audit. And we covered all five reports. We covered it in great detail. The fraud is massive. And the fraud that's massive is not being reported. The one thing that came out the same is the recount. And the recount came out the same because they counted the same fraudulent ballots. Now, when they actually go in and examine those ballots and the quality of the paper and the ink and the repetition, the redone things and all the fraud, the recount, you know, the multiple times to the machines, the fact the machines went through the internet, we know that whole story. Okay, we've been all over that. All right. So the Arizona audit has proved that the Arizona vote needs to be decertified. It is not a legitimate vote. Those Biden electors are not legitimate because Biden didn't win. He couldn't have won. Because there's so many votes, there's over 250,000 votes in dispute, and he only won by 10,000 votes. And it doesn't matter that you have multiple times over the vote fraud. Vote fraud is vote fraud, but it really makes the case that there is so much vote fraud over the margin of victory as to make this impossible to do anything else but decertify. And that's what Wendy Rogers is calling for. So there was a letter written September 24th, letter from state legislators to the American people referencing the 2020 election. And this is what they're saying. So to the citizens of the United States of America, we, the undersigned state legislators of the United States, are vested with the plenary power by our U.S. Constitution, Article 2, Section 1, Clause 2, to oversee the election of the President of the United States. It has come to our attention from an audit of 2.1 million ballots in Arizona, complemented by an in-depth canvas of votes in Arizona, as well as through multiple different data reviews of voting by independent experts, that our representative republic suffered a corrupted 2020 election. In addition to Arizona, sworn affidavits have accumulated from many states detailing rampant corruption and mismanagement in the election process. Fraud and inaccuracies have already been shown through multiple audits and canvasses in multiple states, as well as through lawsuits challenging the validity of election results in several counties in multiple states. We have come to the conclusion that all 50 states need to be forensically audited. Voter rolls should be scrubbed with a canvas of voters to ensure future integrity of our elections. Of course, my solution is that that voters re-register every year, that all voter registrations are canceled, are void after December 31st at midnight. Okay, so back to the letter. If results from these measures prove an inaccurate election was held, as has been shown in Arizona and is being shown in many other states, then it is clear that certification of many electors was improperly rendered in January 2021. That'd be January 6th, when they didn't actually even go through it, right? Of the November 2020 United States presidential election. We call on each state to decertify its electors where it has been shown the elections were certified prematurely and inaccurately. If it is shown that either Joe Biden would receive fewer than 270 tallied electoral votes or Donald Trump would receive more than 270 electoral votes, then we call for the U.S. House of Representatives, and this is the 12th Amendment, folks, the U.S. House of Representatives to convene and vote per the U.S. Constitution by means of one vote per state to decide the rightful winner of the election in accordance with the constitutional process of choosing electors. This is our historic obligation to restore the election integrity of the vote as the bedrock of our constitutional republic. If we do not have accurate and fair elections, we do not have a country. Of course, it's signed first by Wendy Rogers, then Sonny Borelli, Kelly Townsend, who I'm actually in contact with, a bunch of other folks here. I published this online. You can find it very easily by going to wendyrogers.org, and just look for her letter. And she has a video of this as well. And she says, this is it. And this is what I'm finding. I thought that if the Biden electors, okay, were decertified, they automatically became Trump electors. And I don't think that's what they're saying now. What they're saying is that Biden, you know, if they decertify Biden in Arizona, which I hope they will, they decertify Biden in Georgia, they decertify Biden in Pennsylvania, he's below 270. We figured out, Gene, it was 259, okay? So he does not have the electoral votes to be president anymore at that point, which means I don't know if they could make them automatically Trump. I would assume they would because they were the only two in the presidential race. Right? But if not, then it goes to the House under the 12th Amendment, and the House decides the election. So if they decertify and you have two candidates below 270, then the race has to go to the House. And that's what I think is going to happen under the 12th Amendment. That's what they're going for, and I agree. And I think that's the way this has to go, at which point Trump will win because he's got more state delegates right now.
It's what should have happened on January 6th, but
okay.
Our side isn't on our side, as Chris Plant
said. Our side isn't on our side. That's probably the best line you've ever had. It's true. Our side is not on our side. Yeah. You're absolutely right. Yeah.
But the, because most people don't understand. Mm-hmm. And again, if you went to a government school, you're damaged, by misinformation.
Mm-hmm.
We do not, of course, and it'd be good. I don't know if you've posted the friend of the court brief that we filed that Action Radio is part of.
I did, but it's been a while.
It explains a lot
people
of this stuff. It should
yeah.
be posted.
Yeah.
People should read it. It's not.
Okay.
I mean, I try, especially something like that. I try to read it in such a way that people can actually get something out of it and understand
mm-hmm.
it. And because we do not vote for president, the Electoral College elects the president.
Uh-huh. That's
and
a good
that's
thing.
That's weird. That was believed to be a compromise against
mm-hmm.
all these competing. So all this stuff that people say, no, our Constitution is supposed to slow things down, and balance competing conflicting interests. It's not supposed to get things done. It's not supposed to be simple. So basically, the state legislature. In every state is completely responsible for
mm-hmm.
every aspect of the Electoral College. And as I think we talked about at the time and our brief says, is there are cases, there's precedence, in fact, quite a lot early on, where the legislature chose the Electoral College members directly
mm-hmm.
without an election. There's even a case where there was a an election was scheduled, and the state legislature canceled it and just chose the Electoral College members itself.
Mm-hmm.
So every aspect of this is constitutionally under the control of the state legislature, which
mm-hmm.
was completely violated in the 2020 election and routinely violated at other times because people don't understand what the heck they're talking about. And
yep.
mainly because we have combined voting. We go to vote that day for president, for Senate, for Congress, for state offices, and for local offices, all on the same piece of paper, which really doesn't make any sense. As Pianki
said.
Well,
this is what Pianki –
so,
we have a bill. Pianki has a bill that actually splits
yes.
the federal and the state ballots, and we should do more with that. I haven't really been following that as closely as I should. I haven't looked into it as much. But you
right.
and Pianki might want to work on that, and let's get that bill
yeah.
out there because you know more about this than I do in terms of how that process works. And Pianki,
well,
obviously. Yeah, go
correct.
Ahead.
But where I'm going with this is that mm-hmm. decertifying it and
right.
everything like that is would have to be up to the state. So those
right.
people in the state will have to convince their fellow weenies to actually vote on it.
Yeah.
So the big battle is going to be for Arizona, mm-hmm. the Congress to actually vote on that, or maybe for the it might involve Secretary of State and. But it really should be the legislature. They should overturn it.
I understand the state legislature. And here's the thing, too, though, because the Congress is supposed to do on January 6th, they're supposed to take any challenges to the electors, and they're also supposed to count
right.
the votes. Well, if Arizona, decertifies their Biden electors, I'm curious to see who's going to challenge that. They'd have to prove that the audit was wrong in all their conclusions. That would be really interesting. But this is a way to decertify.
It would be completely up to the legislature. Is what I'm saying.
Yes, exactly.
If the legislature is convinced.
Mm-hmm.
There's nobody to, there's no place. There shouldn't be any place for anybody else to go.
Yeah.
If the legislature speaks, that's it.
Well, it'd be interesting to see the Democrats are going to take this to court. They're going to say that the state doesn't have the power to do that, which they clearly do. Legislature can do this. So, but here's where it's going to get really interesting is when Arizona, which I believe they will, and hopefully Georgia and Georgia and Pennsylvania will do the same thing. They decertify. Enough states decertify so that both candidates are below 270. You don't have a president. Where are you going to go? The only place to go, unless unless the Congress changes those votes to Trump voters, Trump electors, which should be interesting. I don't know how that would work. But the thing is, then it goes to the House. That's what the 12th Amendment is for, is to decide elections where you don't have a majority candidate. Someone has enough electors to be president, right?
Two things. I think they could attempt to say that the Trump slate should have been appointed. But I don't know if at this point, it's never been done before retroactively to change it. But they could decertify.
We're in exploring territory
here.
we're breaking
the
ground.
Could say no, the Trump slate of electors won, and so we're going to send the Trump. They say it was the Trump vote electors who should
now
be counted.
Are you saying Congress
but
can do that? And this would be a way that Congress wouldn't have to take a vote themselves.
The state could. In the state, there were two slates of electors, possibly a third party, slates of
right.
electors. And based on the popular vote, they can, either one of them won or the other one won, the electors,
mm-hmm.
the state of electors, slate of electors. And in fact, like I say, the state has the power, and they should have done it before, is that they could have stepped in and say, look, our election is disputed, it has problems, therefore we determine that there's been no clear winner, and we're just going to decide. The
yeah.
legislature could do that, and they should have done it. They will complain that they had, under their state constitution, they had no power to convene themselves. They convene at certain times during the year in some states, and the governor can call them into session. But they argued that they couldn't call themselves into session, which I think is cowardly and stupid, because
they're not doing normal state business.
That's emergency.
Pursuant to the U.S. Constitution.
The election is an emergency. Of course, they should call themselves into session. But
well,
I think you're right.
All,
I want to get to Claire because I got Claire on the line here too. So I want to end this conversation.
Well, let me just finish this last
yeah,
one.
Go ahead.
So, everything we've been saying is absolutely clear. Mm-hmm. The states absolutely have all that power. What happens then is something we've never encountered before.
It's I know, isn't it exciting?
The Electoral College retroactively is amended. Yeah. That we have no idea.
Well, there's
it's
a
never happened before.
There's a legal principle. The FinCon, Mark FinCon, who's the Secretary of State candidate for Arizona, says something called the reclamation legal theory, that the kid that steals the candy bar doesn't get to keep the candy bar. The person that steals doesn't get to keep the White House.
That's common sense, but we've never encountered it in this case before.
Well, we've never had a coup like this before either.
I mean, it's certainly common sense, but it's not, we don't know what would happen at that point.
Okay. Well, we're going to find out.
And we know that
I prefer disqualify over decertify. I would disqualify Biden from that election because they committed so much fraud. I would then certify Trump. That's how I would do it. Okay, but I'm not in charge of Arizona.
Like I say, that would empower the state legislature to say, look, because of the problems, fraud or just innocent heart screw up, we cannot certify that this slate of electors won the thing. So we're going to take it over, which they can do, and we're going to declare who we believe is the proper slate of electors.
Okay. Well, if you disqualify Biden,
they don't want to
lose one choice.
They don't want to do it because they're cowards, but that they could do that. What happens next, I have no idea.
Yeah, nobody does. That's the fun of this. This is why it's such an exciting time we're living in. But like I say, my preference is for disqualify, not decertify. Decertify is good, but disqualification is much better. All right, be right back.
However they get there, they can
Both
do
it. Action Radio. Part of the ADHD Radio Network. The ultimate free speech zone. We the people give our consent to be governed through writing the laws by which we are governed and have the power through juries to nullify the laws by which we do not consent to be governed. At Action Radio, we don't report the news. We are the news. Every other show reports what has happened. We talk about what can happen. From the questions no one has thought to ask, to the answers no one has thought to consider, to the actions no one has dared to take. That is Action Radio.
Yeah, you can't talk over my surface. And that's why I want to file that lawsuit that the federal budget is unconstitutional.
Claire, welcome to our Thursday firestorm.
Good morning, all.
Good morning. Do you have a comment or observation on the decertification versus disqualification in Arizona? Are you kind of standing by and watching what's happening?
For a little while. I'm with Jonathan. All of this might have, could have, but didn't happen on January 6th.
Right.
We've got to stop misleading people with false hopes. The election of November 2020 cannot be turned over, cannot be won back, will not be turned over. We don't even know if Arizona will decertify, much less other states like Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Georgia, which have not even begun audits, much less reached a decision or decided to decertify. This is all pie-in-the-sky talk. The election of 2020 is over. What we need to do now is to be sure that we institute measures for election integrity going forward, looking to next year, first of all in 2022 for the midterms. But we've got to stop misleading people that somehow the election of 2020 can be overturned. It cannot.
Yeah. See, this is where we disagree completely, and I'd love to see the sources that you have, because I know you mentioned some people, legal experts last time. And my contention is that you cannot let this stand because, you know, under the theory that you can't rob a bank and keep the money. You know, this is the same kind of thing.
Nice
we can't let.
But
pardon?
It's not legal. There's no legal basis for it. It's a moral sentiment. It's a common sense sentiment, But there's nothing in the Constitution to underpin it whatsoever.
Yeah. See, this is where I disagree, because I think the 12th Amendment is very clear that if they decertify or they found that, or disqualify, that it has to go to the House. They have to be able to decide that once
that
it's shown.
That would be January 6th.
Well,
not
they can still do it.
August, September,
January 6th
November,
was never finished. Yeah,
2021.
That was never finished. Yeah.
It was finished. It's over. It's done.
Okay.
We have to move on.
We just disagree on that, but that's okay. That's not why I have a year. You know, but we should put a little bet on this. We just need to see how this turns out as the months go by. You may very well be right that nothing does happen. I think it will, though. I'm absolutely convinced that Arizona is going to decertify. I wish they disqualify. And in the course of the 22 months from the election, and that's almost 2 years, that we're going to have a couple more states. Hopefully Georgia and Pennsylvania will also decertify, and then it goes to the House per the 12th Amendment for a vote, and then we see what happens. Now, a legal question for both of you. Since Trump, if he gets put back in halfway through his real term, he will only have served a term and a half. Can he then run in 2024, having not served two full terms? Jonathan?
This is ridiculous. This is not going to happen.
Okay.
This is absolute. This is crazy talk.
Hmm.
We have to stop.
Okay. Sometimes we do crazy talk here. Let's get to some of the more important issues. The first one that I really want your opinion on, because I think you got a chance to watch more of these hearings, is General Milquetoast and Lloyd Austin and that general, I don't know who he is, were before both the House and the Senate, I think it was Armed Services Committees. What's your take on what's going on with that?
Yeah. You know, on the one hand, we can say that this was maybe just the mere little beginning of some holding these people to account. The third general you were referring to was CENTCOM Commander General Kenneth McKenzie. That's the third one that was before those committees.
Okay.
And so there were some very good questions put to these officials in both the House and the Senate hearings. And
okay.
They were put on the spot in many cases. And I have to give credit to even some of the Democrat members of House and Senate posed some good, pointed questions. And
anybody
many Republicans
mind?
As well.
Yeah. Any Democrats come to mind?
Let me talk about the questions that I think were the most important.
Okay.
And these were the ones talking, for example, about asking about whether these officials, Secretary of Defense Austin, CENTCOM Commander McKenzie, Secretary of Defense, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Milley, did they recommend to President Biden that a minimum of 125,000 troops, American troops, be left in Afghanistan to ensure stability, holding of Bagram Air Force Base, and the evacuation of all American citizens. And over again, it seemed that each of those officials claimed, at least, that he did recommend keeping a minimum of 125,000 U.S. troops in Afghanistan. Even after an evacuation of all American citizens that wanted to leave.
Was it 2,500? Was it 2,500 or 125,000, I think you said? It's 2,500, wasn't it?
Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah, I think you're
That's
right.
Okay.
2,500. I apologize. Yeah,
no,
2,500
yeah,
minimum.
Numbers throw me, too. Yeah.
And over again, they said they did recommend this to President Biden.
Mm-hmm.
And then various news outlets, media channels, and so forth, TV channels, were playing clips of prior interviews with President Biden in which he said, no, they never said anything of the sort. They never told me that. They never recommended that. And so you've got a real contradiction set up there between what Biden is saying. Now, I mean, one can say, well, he doesn't know what day of the week it is, much less who told him what when about what numbers of American troops in Afghanistan.
See, that's why he's the
okay.
perfect person. He's got plausible deniability, you know, because he doesn't know. So he can lie.
But it does
he can
seem
tell...
that the,
okay.
the officials, the generals,
yeah.
And Secretary Austin were unanimous in their insistence that they did recommend keeping these troops in Afghanistan. So that was a major point of contention.
Yeah.
But other than that, there was an awful lot of CYA going on. No, I had no idea the Taliban were advancing across Afghanistan. We never dreamed they would take over the Come on, they knew perfectly well.
Yeah.
But they didn't want to do anything about it, or just were incompetent to do anything about it, which is a good part of the problem here. Not a single one of these three is remotely qualified for the position he holds. I mean, just completely incompetent. You wonder how any one of them got past major.
Well, I looked up Lloyd Austin because I was kind of curious about him. He seems to me the affirmative action general. And I wondered, as Secretary of Defense, has he actually had any combat experience? Now, he got a Silver Star, if I remember correctly, for being in command of some combat unit, but I don't know whether he actually did any. It seems like he was a logistics person. He was an executive officer. He has a very distinguished career as a desk jockey.
As a swamp creature, let's just say it. He's a complete and total swamp creature. He arose through bureaucracy, not through competence of any kind, military or any other kind.
Okay. Does being black help him? Is he the affirmative
Probably.
Action general?
Probably. I mean, I don't know. Could be.
Okay. Interesting. Do you know about much of, I haven't really looked up his record, but General Milquetoast, as I call him, Millie, has he ever had a combat command? He's got the jump wings. And we see that prominently
He does.
Displayed.
I'm not sure about that. He doesn't act like he's ever been in combat. He doesn't act like he's ever had combat command experience. Maybe he has. But he, too, is a swamp creature. He's a bureaucrat. He's the penultimate bureaucrat who knows how to, get his promotions, rise in the ranks by doing absolutely nothing controversial ever or taking a stand.
Right.
Or showing any competence whatsoever about anything whatsoever.
Yeah. I used to have what I call my inverse theory of military leadership, is that you get promoted in the military by how good you are as being a follower, following orders. And so you're promoting the greatest followers of orders. And the leaders, the people with the initiative, the people with the creativity, the people that make the best field officers, that can make snap decisions and, react to the situations on the ground with their troops, the leaders get gradually weeded out when you get to a certain level. I think
that's exactly
major, like you were saying. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
That's crazy.
So. Yeah. I mean, the cutoff might be 06. It might be colonel level.
Okay.
But beyond that, anybody who gets past colonel since 9/11 is a career bureaucrat. They're not competent. With exceptions, I'm willing to admit there may be a few.
Yeah. We're fortunate enough through a friend of mine to have Colonel Doug McGregor on the show a few times.
Oh, dear.
He's great.
I would say just the opposite. Sorry.
Okay.
I think he's completely out to lunch and incompetent.
Interesting. Okay. See, I could. Boy,
he
we're
has no idea what he's talking about.
Okay. Why do you think that? Curious.
Because I've heard him speak both in person and many times on media interviews. He really does not know what he's talking about. He's never once identified the enemy. He has no clue how to counter the enemy. Just another one of them.
And that's fine. Hey, listen, I appreciate honest, blunt opinions. So that's, and again, the requirement for anybody that wants to be on my show, callers included, those in the live chat, you do not have to agree with me. That is never a requirement here. Let's get Josie in line. She wants to talk as well. And I think I know what she's going to talk about, so I'm just going to let her go. Josie, you're on with Claire Lopez, Jonathan Mosley, Gene, our producer, and me. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, all. I totally disagree with Claire about Donald Trump. I don't have a lot of time because I have to go to work. But just one quick question. When an Olympic medalist gets a gold medal, if they find out that he cheated, do we let him keep the medal? That's my question to you, Claire.
The answer is that the Olympics is not the same thing as the U.S. presidential election. We are governed by the Constitution. And there's absolutely nothing in the Constitution to overthrow, to reverse an already settled presidential election. There is nothing legal that we have to go on in the Constitution or any law derived from the Constitution to reverse a presidential election. There just isn't. It doesn't exist.
But we let him steal the fraud because it's all well. It was well organized, the whole thing. And we have never had, actually, we have never seen anything like it. The Democrats, they've been cheating for the last 70 years, but we did not know because we didn't think we were like the Spanish country where I'm from. That's all they do, cheat and fraud the whole time. And that's exactly what has happened here. And we are stopping it, and Donald Trump will return to claim his win. And you will see. You will see because I'm very involved
well,
in this.
Cite me the constitutional provision that allows for that. Tell me, where in the Constitution does it say that? Where?
We make things right in America. We obey laws, and these people have breaking
yeah,
every
the Constitution.
Law. They have
There's
breaking
nothing
the Constitution.
In the Constitution about this.
Yeah, but
there
we,
is
we're going to make things
in
right.
In the Constitution to
yeah.
overthrow an election, to reverse an
well,
election.
There was no election. There was no election, first of all. At all, because it was all a lie and a fraud. So we need to fix it before we move forward. There's nothing we can do right now in the eyes of the criminals, of course, but we are going to fix it because this election was a fraud. So it's like if we never had an election, because I voted for Donald Trump and so is 100 million people, and they have stolen the whole thing. And we had never had that happen in America. In America, we obey laws. They have broken our Constitution completely, all of it. And right now, our leaders in the military are breaking our laws, forcing military young men the vaccine, even though the vaccine that the FDA approved hasn't even arrived in the United States until 2023. So all this is a fraud, the whole thing, the election, the vaccine, the COVID. I mean, we are going to fix it. Trust me, we're going to fix it. That's all I can say.
We do need to fix it. We absolutely do need to fix election integrity. And that is happening across the country, I will tell you, from the local level
yeah.
on up, but especially at the local level. And I mean city council level. I mean, state chairman level. I mean the state legislatures, county district. That's where it's being fixed. That's where the scrutiny will be. That's how we fix this. But we can't go backwards.
Well,
that's water under the bridge.
I keep hearing people say, oh, we're not going to let it happen again. No, we're not going to let it happen at all. The 2020 election will be fixed. You'll see it. So you have a blessed day. I got to go. And you're awesome.
Thanks, Jesse.
With all your
yeah.
other support. But this time you're wrong. Got that.
It's very interesting. And again, this is why I love this show, because we can have these kind of really strong debates, because people do have very strong convictions and very strong opinions. And you know where I stand, and I stand by it. And we will see as this goes forward what happens. It's going to be very interesting. Jonathan, you've been quiet. Let's get the lawyer in on this. Do you want to add to this? And then I have some North Korea questions.
First time, and I do think there's a lot going on with Afghanistan and stuff. But just in terms of the comment.
Mm-hmm.
I think that what alarms people so much, starting with the New York Post being suppressed and everything else, is the idea that we're never going to have an honest election again. And, and I do think that is at least half of all of this, possibly a lot more than half. And I think people are trying very hard to make sure it doesn't happen again. You know, I know conservatives who still do not believe that we're going to win in 2022. Simply because it's cheating.
I'm one of those, by the way.
And unfortunately, there were so many different kinds of problems, cheatings, mistakes, blunders, that, we have to address all of them, coming with, social media to, if just the social media alone had happened, it would be, a thrown election. But anyway, I do think that, some people, your approach is, let's push it to the line just as an educational point and to for, and to get a thing. I do think that's what's happening in our country, is that people are waking up and learning how things work through some of these things. But after the states, if the states amend, I don't think anybody can stop them from amending their
their electors. I have no idea what happens after that. Like Clara said, there's no precedent and no basis for, you know, predicting what that would be. But yeah. If all that does is make, I had something like this happen in election law school, I won't go into it, but you know, the only reason you're fighting it was to make sure it never happens again. And that may be what we have to do.
Yeah. And and I'm with that camp that the 2022 midterms, my test was the California recall. And I think there was the fact that they've now made vote fraud by mail, as I call it, permanent. The fact that the GOP completely let that go, that they didn't have observers in the post offices, which are now basically campaign offices of the Democrat Party. You know, and the fact that they're election counters and they're everything else. The minute you separate the voter's ballot from the ballot box and the one person who counts it, you know, the minute you have any intermediaries in between, you've got vote fraud. You know, it's either little or a lot. So the fact that the GOP geldings, the gelding old party, didn't stop the fraud for the December election of the two Georgia senators, they didn't stop any of the fraud that I know of in the California recall election, I see no reason to expect that they'll be any different in the 2022 election. I don't think that the Republicans are automatically going to take the House and the Senate. Everybody thinks that they are because they spoke, because, you know, Biden's a horrible old person and all this kind of stuff. It doesn't matter. Because the Democrats are out-cheating the Republicans, and until they figure that out and stop it, then it's just going to keep going. Let's get to Claire Specialties. We've got about 20 minutes left. And Gene, I know you're there, so feel free to join us anytime if you want to as well. I'm going to go to North Korea, then let's see the latest in Afghanistan. North Korea is testing missiles again. You know, we had a big thing with Dr. Pry on Monday on this. They have these mobile truck launched ICBMs that they're parading through their streets right now. This wasn't happening during, you know, Trump, who actually talked to Kim Jong-un. And now we've got a situation where, of course, you know, President, you know, thief in chief is just sitting there. We don't know what he's doing. Is anybody talking to North Korea in the way that they did under the Trump administration?
Well, certainly not in the way they did under the Trump administration. Okay. Nobody respects or fears the Biden administration. They just don't. So rogues of the world are doing what rogues do. They're running rogue because there is nothing to stop them, nothing to intimidate them, nothing to deter them. The biggest part of avoiding wars is deterring them in the first place, Sunsa.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not doing that right now. We are transmitting to the entire world the impression, the perception, that we are weak, hapless, witless, cognitively impaired, incompetent. I mean, it's open season. Without America, we can see what happens to the world, and it's chaos.
I wonder if, and I don't like the way we're doing it, but I wonder if it's not a good thing that, like, Australia's buying nuclear subs, that probably Japan is strengthening their defenses, that Taiwan, I'm sure, is buying, you know, arms wherever they can, and India, you know, part of the Quad here. If these countries aren't picking up the slack, that it's something they could have done all along and not have relied on the U.S. so much. Even during the Trump administration, it would have been nice to have more participation of these other nations in the South China Sea, in any place where China's being aggressive, and any aggressor around the world, Middle East included, that if these, and Europe especially, you know, NATO. I mean, they're probably back to us paying all their defense again. But these countries should have picked up the flag. They're doing it. It's a terrible situation now with Biden where he is in the White House. But shouldn't these nations have picked up their defense anyway?
Well, I think for the first time since World War II, if we're going to talk the Pacific, the Far East, these nations, including the Quad, which is the U.S., Australia, India, and Japan, mm-hmm. but the others in the region who are allies and friends, like Taiwan, like South Korea, mm-hmm. They're feeling threatened, this time, of course, by the Chinese Communist Party and its aggression. And perhaps they had long sort of glided by, depending on a U.S. naval presence and a nuclear umbrella shield over them. And now they're realizing, well, maybe they put too much trust in all of that, and maybe they, you know, need to do a little more on their own. So I agree with you, Greg, that this nuclear-powered sub, by the way, deal.
That's right. Yeah, we should make
with
that
Australia,
point. Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
Is a good deal. Do I think that we could have manage things more diplomatically with the French, who, of course, also are our close allies since the Revolutionary War. Yeah, we really flubbed that. But nevertheless, what the French were offering the Australians in the deal that they'd been discussing for a very long time were conventional diesel-powered subs, which cannot stay submerged as long or as deeply and make a whole bunch more noise. So they're not silent, they're not stealthy as nuclear-powered subs are. It just wasn't as good a deal. The UK had not shared this technology before. That's another thing. This is new, that we have made the decision, UK and US, to share this nuclear submarine technology with Australia. Huh. That decision is a first. So that I think, is a good thing. And, you know, if the Aussies can stop themselves from falling into complete and utter stormtrooper tyranny, maybe they'll be worth the effort.
And this is a place I lived for several years, so you know, half my family is Australian, you know, my father's side. So it's interesting. I have a real special place for Australia.
To them.
I'm sorry. What was that?
My sympathies to your family members.
Well, you know, it's up to the people too. I mean, they could start. I'm actually working with people in Australia right now to do what we're doing here, to create a citizen legislature, to have people start advocating laws that they consent to be governed by. They don't have to take this. And the whole point of this is education, is, you know, providing alternative laws that, you know, if enough people start supporting, it's going to make an impact. I'm not sure how yet. Again, we're in uncharted territory here. In fact, everything we do is uncharted. That's what makes it so much fun. But it's just it's fascinating to me that the French, who have been a nuclear power, I remember when the French were doing nuclear tests. I think I was in Australia at the time. You know, they were doing them somewhere between Australia and New Zealand. I think not Tahiti, but in that general region in the South Pacific, they were doing above ground nuclear tests until they finally brought them underground. So the French have been a nuclear power. They're one of the first ones. Do you remember the order that nations got the atomic bomb? We had it first. Then I think Russia got it. Then China. Then maybe
then
France.
China. And then it was a free for all, pretty much.
Okay. All right. So does France have nuclear submarines, nuclear powered subs?
I don't believe they do. Again, that technology is something that was not shared previously outside of U.S., U.K., and I don't know if there are any others.
So this is interesting, too, because, you know, Canada and Australia and New Zealand are major, former you know, colonies, but they are British Commonwealth, united language, culture, and everything else countries. Why wouldn't Britain share with –
Canada. Certainly have – the Five Eyes intelligence sharing commitment among the English-speaking nations, you know, Australia and Canada and New Zealand and the U.S. and the U.K., the Five Eyes, as that's called. But that's for intelligence sharing. That was not for military technology sharing. It's a different thing. Given the way that New Zealand and Australia are going, I can see why we might be hesitant to share not only intelligence matters anymore with them, but nuclear technology. I'm glad that we're sharing the nuclear sub technology with Australia. I just hope they can pull themselves out of the abyss before they fall completely into communism and tyranny.
Yeah, it's strange because Australians, you know, by nature are incredibly, incredibly freedom loving. They are competitive. They are fun. They're, you know, the gene pool is Irish prisoners. So you've got a pretty.
I mean, we thought so, and I myself was there on a speaking tour back in 2016, and I was in Perth and Melbourne and Sydney and Brisbane, and it was marvelous. It was wonderful. Loved it. Loved the people, but that's not what I see on the streets of these cities today. Not at all what I see. And, of course,
scary
New Zealand's
how fast
completely
changed.
Gone, so write them off.
Yeah. I have a friend in New Zealand, too, where we used to live around here. New Zealand doesn't want anything to do with nuclear weapons. They don't even want nuclear-powered or nuclear-armed ships.
No, they'd rather be suborned to Chinese communism. I'm sure that would suit them much better. That's the direction they're going.
Yeah, Australia, I mean, it started with the guns. You know, it's interesting that all these things start with gun control, gun bans. You know, you take away the independence of the people, and it's scary that you look around the world, and here too especially, how many people, how quickly gave up their constitutional rights, gave up their freedoms, stopped going to church, put on masks, didn't fight to keep their businesses open, let the large corporations and the government bureaucracies, you know, do whatever they wanted and stay open. Everybody else had to lock down. And so many millions of people went along with it that it was able to happen, and there was no legal basis for any of it. And yet,
people did it. And all of that was based on completely and totally irrational fear of a stupid virus that's a little more, you know, a little more scary than the common flu, you know, with an over 99% survival rate. But they bought into the fear. I never understood the fear. I never got that. And to this day, I don't get that. Yeah. You know, having had the virus myself, I just don't get why people either were or are afraid of it. But that was the basis for giving up all their liberties.
You know, everybody's had the virus.
To give that up.
If you listen to a pharmaceutical expert, everybody's either had or been exposed to the virus multiple times. And those that with natural immunity, you know, or those that had it and developed natural immunity, or those that, you know, that's most people. You know, you say the term survival rate's kind of, I think it's misleading. It's really, you know, 99.5%. I'm trying to think of a good term for it because it's more than survivable.
Recovered from exposure.
It's minimal impact for most of those people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, people do die of this, but people die of heart attacks and strokes and obesity and diabetes too, and those are the things that have contributed along with very advanced age, I mean like above 80, to the death count. It's not the virus itself. It's not the virus, although it is, and this is a whole other subject for another day, bioengineered in the bioweapons labs of the Chinese Communist Party, the People's Liberation Army, yes. Mm-hmm. And we don't fully know what they did to it in the genetic sequencing manipulation.
Well, it's just never been fully isolated.
The death count,
what they say,
the world over, has a whole lot more to do with comorbidities, obesity, and, yes, advanced age than the virus itself.
But psychology is what is so fascinating and so terrifying that people are so willing to give up their freedom. You know, we're not the land of the free and the home of the brave. We're the land of the compliant and the home of the terrified. You know, it's fascinating to me the way this works. And people, if you put relative perspective, I mean, people, I don't know how many thousand people a year die of bee stings, but we don't ban honey. You know, I mean,
or bees.
We don't kill all the bees. Yeah, we need the bees. But I mean, how many people die on the freeways, but we don't stop driving? You know, people, the 40,000
well,
people allegedly.
Well, we have a generation post World War II, couple generations that have grown up soft. They haven't faced real adversity. Yeah. You know, they didn't go off like my father and my uncle to the war fronts. They happened to be on the European front or the Pacific front. They didn't have to face that. Yes, there were wars, and our best and bravest fought in them. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't on the scale of a World War II or a Great Depression. They haven't had to face that. They've grown up in a period of really generally increasing prosperity, increasing comfort and security, and they've lost the pioneering spirit of our forebears.
Yeah. That's what I hope to inspire a whole bunch of folks. That's why I try and bring younger folks into the program here. We've got about 8 minutes left. I want to touch on John Bolton. And John Bolton, to me, represents the permanent war class. We always have to be at war somewhere. And his latest pronouncement that the Taliban, who you've taught us, you know, are that means student, and that we're talking about something that Pakistan created, he's saying the Taliban, you know, the Pakistan-sponsored Taliban might seize nuclear weapons of Pakistan and use them. I find that a little hard to believe. Is that propaganda to get us back in a war, or is there actually a legitimate danger there?
I'm not sure why he would say that or think that. Okay. I think that's highly unlikely. Yes, the Pakistanis are a jihadi regime with deliverable intercontinental range nuclear missiles. Yes, the nuclear weapons. Yes, they have those. But that they would allow their own creature, after all, the Taliban, which are essentially a bunch of savage tribesmen, to somehow seize it, that's just unrealistic. I don't know where that comes from, and I can't see that happening.
Okay. I think it's I'm going to go with my original assumption then, that he just wants a war. He wanted us in Venezuela. He's wanted us in Syria. He wants us wherever we can go. I saw him at CPAC in 2018. I was like 10 feet away from him, and I looked into those cold eyes of his. He's this – I don't know what's not there, but there's something missing, I think, from him in terms of –
Well, no, I mean, he's a very, very intelligent man, and strategically I think he's right most of the time.
Yeah.
He's also difficult to get along with, irascible. And abrasive from
so
people who have worked with him. That's just what they have said. But he's right more often than he's wrong. I think he's wrong on the Taliban thing.
Okay.
But there is reason to apply overwhelming, concentrated military force in certain applications, not to get bogged down with hundreds of thousands of troops for 20 years. No.
Mm-hmm.
But the strategic application of overwhelming military force, like Donald Trump did, like President Trump did against what was then called ISIS, the Islamic State, when it was just still in Iraq and al-Sham.
Mm-hmm.
Today, of course, it's Islamic State because it's all over the place. It's
yeah.
not ISIS anymore. But when it was, he applied direct and overwhelming force and dismantled them. He obliterated them. That is the proper use of military force. And in that, I think Bolton is right, but not getting bogged down for decades in unwinnable situations and morphing the mission into nation building.
Yeah, which surprises me, or doesn't surprise me, that nobody asks about the thing that you brought to our attention, that in 2004 the State Department wrote a constitution for Afghanistan that guaranteed a Sharia law Islamic republic. So there was no other option, you know, than what happened. Even if we had won the war, we still would have won the war on behalf of an Islamic fundamentalist constitution, and that never came out in the hearings at all. Is Congress completely unaware of that? I mean,
don't
you know,
know that they know that or have remembered that. I just don't know what they know and don't know. There's an awful lot they don't know. I mean, the thing's in English online. Anybody can look at it.
We've done it.
They just
I went over it. Yeah, I read the first three sections on the air because, you know, and other parts
yeah,
of it.
Yeah,
we go
right.
over stuff like that. Okay. There was two more questions. I think we've got just some time for these.
Okay.
Pakistan. As much as Pakistan is an Islamic fundamentalist republic.
No, it's not fundamentalist. It's authoritative orthodox Islam.
Okay. What's the difference?
But not, I mean, fundamentalist, I wouldn't use that term. I would say it's faithful.
Make
it's
me more
devout.
Accurate.
It's practicing. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So, but but they have a Sharia law basis, right? The laws are Sharia law? That's what they follow?
Yes, they do. They do.
Okay. So you've got a situation where you have, you know, Islam is the dominant theology, Sharia law is the legal system, and yet they still are responsible enough to not let their nuclear weapons, you know, go to anybody. So it's like these nations are I guess, you know, in the religious beliefs, what we would call extreme, but there's still a sense of responsibility.
No, they're not extreme at all. They're absolutely mainstream. Straight up the middle, normative, orthodox Islam. It's nothing extreme about it. Extreme and radical mean deviation from the norm. This is not deviation from the norm. This is the norm.
Okay, so I'm trying to get at how a nation like Pakistan can be both Sharia law, Islamic, and still maintain the safety of the nuclear weapons. That's what I'm trying to sort
of
balance
these two. I mean, the nuclear weapons are primarily a counterweight to the nuclear capability of India, a free, democratically, representative-run state country.
Hmm.
So, of course, they keep control of their nukes. Why wouldn't they?
No, I mean, it makes perfect sense to do so. I'm just, you know, because like my perception of these, like Iran, God forbid they ever get them. They may have them already. But would Pakistan want to have nuclear weapons as in case Iran has designs on the rest of the Islamic world?
Well, I don't know that Iran has, the Iranian regime has ever expressed any sort of aggressive design on the rest of the Islamic world.
Mm-hmm.
Their aggression is aimed at the Dar al-Harb, the house of war, the places on earth that are not under Islamic law.
Okay. All right, that makes sense then.
Nor would Iran ever share its nuclear weapons with Hezbollah. Shares a lot of other technology and weapons and tactics and everything else with them, but they're not going to give their nukes to Hezbollah, for example. Why would they?
Yeah. So, I find it interesting the contrast between maybe I'm misusing the term, but the radical nature of these regimes and the fact that they're responsible enough to keep the nuclear weapons in check. I mean, that's a good thing.
Well, they're
I'm not complaining about it.
I mean, they're not stupid. They're not extreme, and they're not radical. They are mainstream, devout, faithful, practicing Muslim regimes.
Okay.
But that doesn't make them stupid. They're not going to just allow, the crown jewels of their military capability to slip away helter skelter to anyone else.
Okay. All right. I've got, I think I only have one question left. Jonathan, if you want to leap in here too, we've got the minute and a half. So let me ask you an easy one. I have this weird feeling that I think Biden's going to announce that they want to move the U.S. Embassy from Jerusalem back to Tel Aviv.
Sorry, they can't do that. It's law. It's already been enacted into law.
Can't do that. Okay, good. Would they if they could, do you think?
He might want to in his more lucid moments or... but it's already enacted into law. It's permanent.
Yeah. The only other thing I want to get into, this is my 60-second warning, to get into was the military being vaccinated in the same way that they were with the anthrax vaccine, which caused Gulf War syndrome, allegedly. Got an opinion on that in the next 30 seconds?
I don't know. I mean, we are so newly into this vaccination period. We do not even know yet what the long-term effects are going to be. We have no idea.
Okay.
Unfortunately, we're just going to have to wait and see.
Yeah. I think we should talk about that next week in terms of readiness of our military forces, especially if there are major health problems that we've gone over. We have a medical freedom report that starts at 6 o'clock on Thursdays Central, so that'll be 7 o'clock Eastern time. Listen, I'm just going to let everybody go because we've got about 18 seconds left. Thank you, Gene, Jonathan, Claire, Jane, our medical reporter, and Josie. Because your name, you haven't got Jason in your name except Claire and me. It's kind of funny. Thank you for a fabulous Thursday, everybody. We're 3 hours now, and so we start at 6 in the morning Central, 7 in the morning Eastern time, and let's do it all again next week. I really appreciate having you all on the show, and I especially appreciate our disagreements because it's nice that we can do that. Greg Penglis for Action Radio at blogtalkradio.com/citizenaction. Back tomorrow morning at 6 o'clock Central time.
Good day.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.